That probably shouldn't have been.
Let's park that word. I haven't used it since I was four, at which point my dear mother taught me to swear properly.
Unspeakable, with me, Phil Wang.
And me, Susie Dent. The word is wangy.
Yes, I've always thought the definition of wangy was intelligent and suave. This Thursday night, 6:30 comedy on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
On FM, on digital and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 28th of October. Good morning. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Michelle Hussein.
Good morning. The headlines today then. Sir Keir Starmer will say in a speech that Wednesday's budget will embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality, but there are better days ahead. We'll talk to the senior Labour politician we've probably heard more from than any other during the general election, the party's former national campaign coordinator and now member of the cabinet as the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Pat McFadden. That's coming up at 8:10. And Labour has suspended the MP Mike Amesbury after he was filmed apparently punching a man to the ground and then punching him five more times as he lay on the floor.
Also in today's programme, as Israeli strikes against Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon continue, a former Israeli Prime Minister and a former Palestinian Foreign Minister will tell us about the peace plan they've worked out together. Jack Draper has just won the biggest tennis title of his career at the Vienna Open.
Those guys are legends, you know, legends of British tennis, and to be a part of that group winning here in Vienna. So maybe I'll come back here and win more than they did here. So we'll see.
And we'll be talking about this.
Good morning to listeners of the Today programme and actually all the listeners of BBC Radio 4. This is Michael Parkinson, or at least a version of me in this rather curious AI form.
It's a form which has led to a new version of Parkinson in a podcast. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
Sir Keir Starmer will prepare the ground for the budget with a speech this morning in which he'll say that Britain must embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality. The Chancellor's statement on Wednesday is expected to be one of the most significant in recent history, with tax rises and spending cuts worth tens of billions of pounds. The Conservatives have accused Sir Keir of running a government of broken promises. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
The Prime Minister will say it's time we ignored the populist chorus of easy answers and were realistic about where we are as a country. In a speech in the West Midlands, Sir Keir Starmer will attempt to frame what he admits will be a difficult budget in the context of what he calls the harsh light of fiscal reality. He will argue the country faces the unprecedented challenge of weak public finances alongside crumbling public services. And he'll promise to run towards what he calls the tough decisions. The Chancellor is expected to increase taxes by billions of pounds, as well as change the rules around debt to allow more borrowing for longer-term infrastructure projects. But senior Labour MPs have told me of their concern about the gloomy warnings ahead of the budget, as well as fears councils and prisons are among areas that could miss out on extra funding.
The Office for Budget Responsibility has defended its decision to publish on the same day as the budget a report on what the government says is a black hole in the public finances inherited from the last Conservative administration. The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has written to the OBR expressing significant concern about the timing. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
In his letter to the OBR, Jeremy Hunt said its decision to publish its review at the same time as the budget would be seen as a political intervention. His concern that the timing is designed to make the case that tax rises are the result of a black hole in the last government's spending forecasts, which the OBR was not told about at the time. Last night, the OBR said the review was about its institutional relationship with the Treasury, not the conduct or decisions of ministers. During his time in office, Mr. Hunt was a notable supporter of the OBR, saying the Truss administration's decision to sideline the forecaster was the biggest reason for the crisis caused by the mini-budget 2 years ago. The current Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, told the BBC last week that what she called the £22 billion black hole was one of the reasons tax rises were needed, and the OBR would be publishing its review on how that was allowed to happen.
The Labour MP Mike Amesbury has been suspended from the party after footage emerged appearing to show him punching a man. Cheshire police said a 55-year-old man had been interviewed voluntarily under caution following the incident in Frodsham in the early hours of Saturday. Mr. Amesbury has said he felt threatened. Graham Satchell reports.
The video appears to show Mike Amesbury hitting a man in the jaw and knocking him to the ground. The footage acquired by the Daily Mail then shows Mr. Amesbury apparently punching the man a further 5 times while he's on the floor. The MP for Runcorn and Helsby has now been voluntarily interviewed under caution by Cheshire Police and released pending further inquiries. In a statement, Labour said Mike Amesbury's membership of the party had been suspended pending an investigation. On social media, Mr. Amesbury said he'd felt threatened before the incident, had reported it to the police himself, and would cooperate with their inquiries.
Negotiations about a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of hostages being held there by Hamas are due to take place in Qatar. The Qatari Prime Minister is expected to meet Israeli and US intelligence chiefs. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, reports from Jerusalem.
Israel says that meetings in Doha will look at the various possibilities to restart negotiations for the release of dozens of hostages still held by Hamas. While Hamas is not taking part, many of its leaders are based in Qatar. In an effort to break the deadlock in talks, Egypt has proposed a 2-day truce during which 4 hostages would be freed. The plan also includes the release of some Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, the delivery of desperately needed humanitarian aid to Gaza, and 10 days of negotiations on a permanent ceasefire.
A prolific people smuggler has told BBC News about the forgery and fraud used to help migrants from Vietnam to reach Europe and the UK. This year, more Vietnamese people have crossed the channel in small boats than any other nationality. Our correspondent Andrew Harding spoke to the smuggler, who now lives in the UK.
The man spoke to us on condition that we keep his identity confidential. He provided details to us about his work forging fake documents, things like bank statements and payslips, for Vietnamese people applying for visas to get to Europe. Once in the EU, many of them head to the French coast, where Vietnamese gangs arrange for crossings by small boats to the UK.
It's a very lucrative business. If you have a good reputation, the clients come to you. No force, no violence.
How do you justify what you do here? You've come to the UK illegally. You're still breaking the law by assisting other people to come here illegally.
I just do paperwork. I help people to travel. I don't force them to take certain routes.
The man denied trafficking people to the UK to work for criminal gangs. As part of our investigation, we contacted a different Vietnamese people smuggler in northern France who offered our undercover reporter a place on a small boat for £2,600.
The French actor Gérard Depardieu will appear in court in Paris today, charged with sexually assaulting 2 women while they were shooting a film in 2021. The 75-year-old star has been accused of sexual offences by several women, but this is the first case to go to trial. He denies the charges.
Charles, thanks very much. And at 6:07, let's get our first taste on the Monday morning of the weather from Matt Taylor, who is at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Matt. Hope you're doing OK today.
Good morning, Emma. Very well, thank you. Well, after the sunshine yesterday, I'm not bringing great news as far as the weather's concerned. Bit of a grey and grisly start to the new working week, certainly for England and Wales. Not cold, though. Temperatures start to the day in Rhyl and North Allerton at 15 degrees. Bit of a breeze, though, will temper things across England and Wales, but what we have is extensive low cloud around hills and coasts in the west. It's going to remain fairly misty all day long as well. Just about anywhere across England and Wales can see rain or drizzle come and go through the day. A few heavier bursts in the short term across northern England, Wales and also Cornwall. But there will be some drier moments out there, and if you are lucky, you will see a few cloud breaks. Best favourite for the cloud breaks and any glimpses of the sunshine tend to be across northeast England, Cheshire, the northwest Midlands and maybe towards parts of Kent and Sussex later on. But overall, a fairly cloudy day. Same too for Scotland, really, although the rain had drizzled lighter and patchier here this morning, mainly across Northern Ireland, Central and Southern Scotland. Further north of Scotland, it's dry. We'll see some sunshine at times in Orkney and Shetland. The rain had drizzled elsewhere across Scotland, Northern Ireland will start to fizzle out a little bit, so the afternoon looking drier, and there will be 1 or 2 cloud breaks here and there. Temperatures today across the UK, well, Northern Scotland around 9 to 12 degrees, but generally well above average for late October, 14 to 17 the high. Tonight, we stick with some clouds, some light rain or drizzle, and temperatures no lower than around 9 to 13 degrees. At least tomorrow, hopefully, a few more cloud breaks around.
Thanks very much, Matt. 6:09. Now for a look at the morning papers and what's on the news websites. The Times features Keir Starmer's warning that Britain must face the harsh light of reality ahead of Labour's first budget. in 14 years. That's coming, of course, on Wednesday. The paper says the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is set to announce tax increases that could raise an additional £35 billion as the government prioritises investment in schools, hospitals and other public services. The Guardian says the Prime Minister will bat away concerns from some senior Labour figures by insisting that working people need better public services more than lower taxes.
The Daily Telegraph highlights the criticism of the budget watchdog by the former Conservative Chancellor Jeremy Hunt after he accused the Office for Budget Responsibility of bias for preparing to publish a review of the public finances inherited from the Tories on the same day as the budget. The paper says Rachel Reeves is expected to seize on the document as she makes what it calls raids on national insurance, inheritance tax and capital gains tax while blaming the Conservatives. The OBR says its findings are limited to its relationship with the Treasury and there will be no comment on the conduct or decisions of ministers.
The government's plan to levy VAT on private school fees has sparked an international row. That's according to the Financial Times. It says France and Germany have both registered protests warning the policy risks damaging relations with the UK. They've called for fee-paying international schools that are part-funded by overseas governments to be exempt from the levy, which is due to come into force in January. The Treasury says ending tax breaks on private schools will help to fund the government's education priorities.
Sir Keir Starmer's told the Daily Mirror that voters should judge him in 5 years by whether they have more money in their pocket. Writing in the paper, the Prime Minister looks ahead to what he describes as a landmark week, saying this is a moment to reject austerity, chaos and decline and choose a clear path of stability, investment and reform. The Daily Express isn't convinced. It says there are fears the budget could wreck the economy after analysts warned that changes to debt rules could spook the city.
Moving over to The Sun, it says an unnamed TV soap star has been arrested on suspicion of sexually abusing 5 teenage boys. It reports that police seized computers and documents from the man's home as part of their investigation into the claims, which date back to the 1990s. Officers are said to have acted after examining each of the allegations and finding similarities. The actor denies any wrongdoing and has been released on bail.
And the Times reports about how the cheese retailer Neil's Yard Dairy has been swamped with displays of support after announcing the theft of cheddar worth £300,000. Fraudsters conned the company out of more than 22 tonnes of cheese by impersonating established buyers and distributors in Europe. The paper says offers of financial help and orders for cheese from as far afield as America and Germany have flooded into Neil's Yard. Since the fraud emerged, people have been warned that hundreds of wheels of the stolen cheddar could soon be sold on the black market. We'll hear from one of the cheesemakers later on.
12 minutes past six.
There was a big Donald Trump rally in New York yesterday with just over a week to go to the US election. Gary O'Donoghue, our correspondent, was there.
The pre-programme started at 2 p.m. local time and I think he wrapped up about 8:30, quarter to nine in the evening. So there were 20 odd separate speakers before him, many of his sort of favourites, the retired wrestler, a couple of children, and of course Elon Musk, who appeared, as well as Melania Trump, and a very rare appearance introducing her husband. So it was a party as well as a rally. It's somewhere he's wanted to go for a long time. It's his hometown. Not much political point in being here in New York, to be honest. A blue state that's going to stay blue for this presidential election. But he wanted to do it, and he did it, and he may well have raised quite a lot of money out of it because it was full.
What did he say?
He said all the usual stuff. He hit the main notes on things like inflation, the economy, of course, lots of rhetoric on immigration, promising to have the largest deportation of migrants ever in history, all the superlatives you would expect. Threw in a few bits of extra red meat in terms of, you know, calling for the death penalty for migrants who kill Americans, things like that. So, you know, and targeting Kamala Harris as he does in that kind of personal way. So that was not terribly unusual. I think the spectacle was the thing that was very striking because it felt a little bit like a sort of victory rally, but a victory rally obviously before the fact.
And how are things looking with just over a week to go? What's your analysis of the polls? Is it all on a knife edge?
I would take a 50 pence coin and I would flip it and take your pick. All the seven key swing states are within 1 to 2 points the candidates of one another. And that's well within the margin of error. So no one really knows. So what you're seeing is their strategies focusing particularly on things like, I mean, there's a gender gap here. So Kamala Harris does better among women. Donald Trump does better among men. So, for example, in the last few days, you've seen him on the Joe Rogan podcast, which is very much a sort of aimed at young men. She's been talking about the abortion issue today. So they're trying to maximize their existing advantages in that sense, as well as, you know, sort of ground game in terms of turnout. But you're looking, Michelle, really at a few tens of thousands of voters in these seven states that will decide this election. And bear in mind, there will be north of 140 million votes cast. So they're not quite sure whether they're reaching these people, and the polls are not helping them. They're all kind of within the margin of error, so they're not terribly helpful to anyone.
Gary O'Donoghue, thank you. 14 minutes past six, the inquiry into the death of Dawn Sturgis, the woman who died after being poisoned with a perfume bottle containing Novichok, a chemical nerve agent that was discarded after a failed attempt to assassinate a former Russian agent in Salisbury, is moving to the next stage. Neil Bazou, the police officer who led the investigation at the time and someone we talk to regularly on this programme as the former counter-terrorism chief, has had this to say.
If you asked me to rate my performance, I would say zero, which I've spent a long time trying to come to terms with because I didn't want anybody innocent to die on my watch. The reality of spending any time in national security at any level is that people will die on your watch. What you've got to do is try and get justice for the people who died.
Neil Bazou talking to Marie Lennon, host of the BBC podcast The Salisbury Poisonings, who joins me now. As I say, the inquiry into the death of Dawn Sturgis going to the next stage. What can we say about that, first of all?
Morning, Emma. Yeah, this next stage of the inquiry, although it is into the death of Dawn Sturgis, who was killed when she came into contact with Novichok, the inquiry now moves on to the former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal. And remember, he and his daughter Yulia were targeted 4 months before the death of Dawn Sturgis. So it will focus this week entirely on the Skripals, what happened to them when they were discovered on that park bench in Salisbury in March 2018, who found them, how they were treated, the counter-terror policing investigation, but also who this man was and what his life was like in Salisbury. And the theory is that in establishing what happened in March 2018 and how Novichok ended up in Wiltshire, it's hoped it will bring greater clarity to how it ended up in the hands of a completely unconnected woman, Dawn Sturgis, 4 months later. And importantly, what could have been done, if anything, between those two incidents that could have prevented Dawn's death.
And also, just to say more with your interview with Neil Bazou, he's talked of concern that it could have been an act of war, and how the true horror of that colourless and odourless poison was not knowing how to warn people and what to look for.
Yeah, exactly. He spoke to us at length, myself and co-presenter Andy Howard, about this. He said, as you said, he initially wondered if this could have been an act of war. He said that the amount of Novichok recovered, and it obviously hidden in a perfume bottle, he said that was enough to kill thousands of people. So he viewed this as a weapon of mass destruction. He talked about the bravery of the officers that had to go into various parts of Salisbury and Amesbury and clear this stuff up and the extent of protection they needed. But he also talked about his hopes that the men who were charged, who charges were authorised against, Anatoly Chupiga, Alexander Mishkin, Denis Sergeyev, all alleged to be GRU agents. He talked about his hope that they will one day face justice, but also the lessons between the two incidents. He says that even at the time, there were things that they say they could have done differently. But he says that this was the most complex counter-terror policing investigation that the country has ever known. And as you've already heard, also about his regret that Dawn was killed in this incident.
Marie Lennon, host of that BBC podcast where you can find that full interview and more detail as it unfolds, the Salisbury poisonings. Thank you.
18 minutes past six, it is of course budget week, and that means Sean Farrington has been sprung from the studio for the business news. Good morning, Sean. Where are you and why are you there with that banging in the background?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a busy Jamaican patty factory kitchen that we're in this morning in southeast London in Peckham, chatting to small business owners who are here, the workers here, about what they're looking at in the budget and their concerns. So you can hear the packaging, the removal from the oven of the patties as they come out at the minute. Cheesy Cheesy beef, is it, Mike?
Cheesy beef.
Cheesy beef is the main serving of the day at the minute. And there is a lot of concern amongst the staff here about how Rachel Reeves is going to make up the money to fill the financial black hole that she often talks about, desires for growth. And some of those concerns have come from not just the staff, but maybe the boss as well. Mike, who you just heard from there, the boss of Flake Bakers, kindly agreed to have us. Mike, very good morning to you.
Sean, thank you for having me.
Thanks for hosting us, Mike. The budget Wednesday, cut to the chase. What is it that you're really looking out for?
Well, the key thing that everyone's talking about is NI contributions for employers. And yeah, it's a big concern for us. We're in a small margin business as a manufacturer. So, you know, even a 1% increase is going to have a big impact on us.
So what difference does it make? I think you have about 15 staff overall. I mean, I can see a good portion of them here working in the kitchen this morning. If you have to pay, as an employer, you're going to have to pay more national insurance contributions. What are the consequences on what you want to do next with your business?
We're in the middle of scaling. So where we have a revenue that covers 50% of it, or already revenue goes to staffing. So when we're trying to scale, we're going to have to think about, you know, that additional employee. Do we hire, or do we, you know, try and make things work with the existing team?
Does it hold back your scaling, or can you still crack on because you've grown a lot in recent years?
In terms of the handmade process, we really have to think about how we scale, because again, for every additional employee, that will cost us more, and we need to think about our margins and whether that works for us. So it will impact how we scale.
When you got a big contract with Aldi recently, so clearly things have been on the up. Are you able to weather what might be seen as a storm of increased national insurance contributions? Is that part of the game the Chancellor might be playing here, that businesses like yours can actually cope with this?
I'm not sure a lot of small business will be able to cope with it. You know, before sort of viral moments, we were thinking of closing down, you know, in 2022, 23. So I think all these kind of small changes will have big impacts on small businesses like us.
I've got Munia Burrow with me as well, who is Deputy Chief Executive of Business London, the business group. Morning, Munya.
Good morning.
Are you sort of seeing that reflected across business right across London? I know we often talk to businesses in London who are in the financial services sector, legal services, those kind of things. But, you know, other small businesses that may be manufacturers, what are they thinking at the moment?
I think what businesses really want to see is stability and predictability. And we've been, you know, really short of that for some time. We know that the Chancellor's got a really tough job to balance the books and limited wiggle room, having ruled out so many of the big tax rises. But I think Mike's right that the reports of a NIX rise are worrying. It's going to be difficult for a lot of firms to absorb. They're facing particular cost challenges around things like national living wage and business rates increase. So it's really important that the Chancellor really does get behind things that will drive growth. So that's investment in things like skills, in infrastructure and housing.
And so do you think there's a way for business confidence? You know, just seeing reports in the papers this morning, a Lloyds Bank latest survey, business confidence at its lowest for 4 months. Can business confidence be on the up after this budget?
I think so. I mean, businesses will look at it in the round. So if it sets a path for long-term growth with investment in things like HS2, reform of the apprenticeship levy, a big push on investment in the affordable homes programme, that will send a really strong signal. There are going to be some challenges for business. We know that the public finances are constrained, but we'd want to look at it in the round and see what the mitigations are.
Now, with taxes in employees' pay slips all but ruled out, many businesses this week will be wondering whether they're likely to be hit. At the same time, underfunded public services by central and local government having an effect on businesses. That, according to a survey this morning, nearly 6 in 10 businesses say they've lost staff work days in the last year because of difficulties accessing public services, all according to a poll of 500 businesses done by Opinion for the TUC. And one of those companies surveyed as they put the patties away here in the factory was the home entertainment retailer Richer Sounds. The chief executive, Julie Abraham, joins me down the line now. Julie, morning to you. Have you seen that, those consequences where public services have impacted your ability to get what you need done at Richer Sounds?
Absolutely. But first, can I just say,
This is not a criticism of the people in those public services. I think the nurses, doctors, police, etc. do a fantastic job. I just think they've been underfunded for many years, and we're now seeing the effect of that. But yeah, we're certainly seeing that on the shop floor, the productivity. What used to be maybe a couple of days off, if you can't get the treatment or see a doctor and get the medication you need, suddenly 2 days off is four, five, maybe six. And when if it's a longer term health issue, that is the rise is exponential. So yeah, we're definitely seeing that.
So does the argument then go, Julie, that if you are going to see as an employer an increase on the national insurance contributions you're making, for example, that actually do you see those taxes and those increases as worthwhile if it is going to go, the money's going to be able to go into public services to improve those?
Yeah, all responsible and good businesses, I won't say happy, no one's happy to pay tax, but we recognise we need to pay tax if we want the good public services that help support our business. My biggest concern is hearing that national insurance is going to go up for employers, which I think is going to raise about 20 billion. What I'd really like to see is the plan as how they're going to spend that 20 billion. And also, I'd like to be honest about how long it's going to take to see the improvements, because it's not going to be overnight.
And Julie, is there an overriding concern that you might have with the budget, or you know, are you feeling, as Richard sounds, you're going to be able to grow the way you need to on the back of this budget? You know, potential future, longer term investment, ability to borrow a bit more, is that all tallying to a budget you would back, or do you have concerns?
I'd be daft not to have concerns, because there's still a lot of unknowns about what's going to be announced this week. And it might slow some investment down and growth down, depending on how it pans out. But I think in the long term that we will be safe. And I think we've got plans afoot to deal with any rises. But I say it's the unknown with budgets. There's always a lot of speculation. So and there's always a surprise on the day. That's the one we're all waiting for.
Yep, there often can be. Julie Abraham, Chief Executive of Richer Sounds, the home entertainment retailer, thank you very much. The pasty tax, unsurprisingly, of however many years ago in George Osborne's budget has had a little bit of a mention in the conversations here in this patty factory in Peckham in South East London. I've got Rachel Winter with me, who's investment manager at Killick & Co, has come the few miles from the City of London to join us here. Rachel, lots of people are watching what is going on in the debt markets, as we call them, the cost, effective cost of government borrowing as we change our spending plans. What are you seeing?
Well, we have seen a bit of an increase in government bond yields over the last couple of days, and that suggests that some people are concerned that perhaps the amount of UK debt might be set to rise over the near future, and therefore they're a little bit more nervous about holding UK debt, and therefore the rate of return on that debt needs to be a little bit higher to compensate for holding it.
Are these unusual moves?
They're not huge moves, but it's not unusual to see them in the run-up to a budget. I don't think we will see anything as drastic as we did with the mini-budget, but nevertheless, we are certainly seeing a movement in the upward direction in terms of bond yields.
Because you know, a lot of people, maybe for the first time, were aware of how much a budget and the big policy decisions that come out of it can impact interest rates in particular. That happened around the mini-budget with Kwasi Kwarteng's budget, Liz Truss as Prime Minister then. How is this different this week then, if you say the moves aren't on the same scale?
Well, to put it into context, the 10-year government bond yield was about 3.7% earlier this year. Now it's about 4.2%, so not a huge move there. So I don't think people need to be too concerned. And it's possible that the moves are not actually related to the budget. We actually had some comments from the governor of the Bank of England last week saying that perhaps inflation might be a bit more sticky than people had previously thought. And that would also mean that interest rates here in the UK would not go down as much as previously thought. So the movements we're seeing in the bond markets may be related to that as well.
What do you make of these comments from Jeremy Hunt, former Chancellor, of course, saying that the report that's to be released on the same day as the budget by the Office for Budget Responsibility, a body that is independent of the government, is expected to criticise his party, his time in charge, about the finances it left for the Labour government. And he says it's sort of helping make the case for Labour's tax rises. It breaks impartiality of the OBR, does it?
I think he's got a point that the timing is not particularly fair. So the OBR is supposed to give an impartial review of government finances and government spending, and it doesn't seem particularly fair to have a potentially negative report coming out on the same day as the budget, when we know that Rachel Rees will be standing up and saying we've got this £22 billion black hole and it's due to the Conservatives. So I think the timing could be a lot fairer.
So maybe timing could be fairer. So if there's therefore a question mark over the Office for Budget Responsibility's sort of actions here, does that then have a little bit more of a question mark over trust in the ability for us to sort of regulate and keep an eye on our own financial decisions as a country if so much onus is often put on the OBR?
I don't think so. I think the report will still be accurate, and I think the report itself and what it contains will be fair. I just don't think it's particularly fair to publish it on the exact day of the budget.
Rachel, thank you. Rachel Winter from Killick & Co. I'll be back after 7 o'clock, where we'll be having a bit more chat. We've got the Royal London Chief Executive, one of the biggest investors in the UK, has joined us here at the bakery. We'll be chatting to him about what he's thinking about major investment decisions just after 7, and be learning plenty more about patty making as well, I'm sure, between that time.
Sean, I'm quite jealous. Make sure you have a few. It's early. It's Monday. Enjoy. Let's now at 6:30 get our first update on the sport. Carthy's here. Morning, Carthy.
Morning, Emma. Thank you very much. A 2-2 draw between Premier League title rivals Arsenal and Liverpool yesterday at Emirates Stadium means Manchester City start the week at the top of the table. And with Liverpool having to come from behind twice in that draw, it was their manager Arne Slot who was the happier of the two.
The only thing I look at is can you get a result in a difficult away game as this one? And the way we did it pleased me a lot, and we're only 9 or 10 games into the season. But to see that we can compete with such a strong Arsenal team in their stadium, that is very pleasing to see.
Chelsea are up to fifth place after a 2-1 win over Newcastle United. The Manchester United manager, Erik ten Hag, was unhappy at a late penalty decision in their 2-1 defeat to West Ham, while Crystal Palace had their first win of the season, defeating Tottenham 1-0. And Celtic are back at the top of the Scottish Premiership after a 3-0 win over Motherwell. The British tennis number one, Jack Draper, has won the biggest title of his career at the ATP 500 level in Vienna and will be the new world number 15 today. The US Open semi-finalist has had injury issues over the years, but feels this is an important title win for his confidence.
I'm still young, I've still got time, and I'm still trying to figure out what makes me tick and what makes me stay calm on the court. You know, there's no doubt in that a lot of physicality is linked to mentality as well, with the anxiety of being out there on the court. Tennis is an extremely tough mental sport, so you kind of have to have the full package if you want to be great.
The British driver Lando Norris has described Max Verstappen as dangerous after the championship leader was given a penalty for forcing Norris off the track in Mexico City in an eventful race that was won by Ferrari's Carlos Sainz. The BBC's F1 commentator Harry Benjamin has the details.
Ferrari stand on the top step in Mexico for the first time in 34 years, with Carlos Sainz, who won comfortably ahead of Lando Norris in the McLaren, with Charles Leclerc completing the podium. Max Verstappen only managed sixth after two time penalties for an incident with Norris, with the McLaren driver closing the gap in the championship to 47 points. Ferrari usurped Red Bull in the team's championship and are now just 29 points behind McLaren, who topped the table. Four rounds to go, both championships still up for grabs, and it's back to the sprint format next weekend in Brazil.
In rugby league, England's men defeated Samoa by 34 points to 18 in the first match of their two test international series. And in golf, England's Liz Young has won the Women's Indian Open by one shot to claim her second Ladies European Tour title.
Carthy, thank you for that.
Was Anne Boleyn really a wicked queen?
People feared women who were smart.
Slay girl.
Exactly. What about Rasputin? A miraculous mystic or a diehard deviant?
I think there's some bad stuff in there. I do weirdly respect him.
On Evil Genius, we're the judges of that. Join me, Russell Cain, and a host of comedians as we put more historical legends under scrutiny to find out if they're evil or genius. Evil Genius. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Need to check that out, I think. 27 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today. Good to have you with us on this Monday morning on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Michelle Hussein. And Charles Carroll is here with a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech today to warn of unprecedented economic challenges, but will say better days are ahead. The Prime Minister is expected to set the tone for the budget on Wednesday by saying that Britain needs to embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality. The Conservatives accuse the government of broken promises. The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, says the Office for Budget Responsibility has abandoned impartiality by deciding to publish on the same day as the budget a report about what the government calls the black hole in the public finances. Labour says it inherited the shortfall from the last Conservative administration. The OBR says the review is about its institutional relationship with the Treasury. The MP Mike Amesbury has been suspended from the Labour Party after footage emerged which appeared to show him punching a man. Cheshire Police said a 55-year-old man had been interviewed voluntarily under caution and later released. Talks on a ceasefire in Gaza and hostage release deal are due to take place in Qatar today. The Qatari Prime Minister will meet Israeli and US intelligence chiefs. Hamas is not taking part in the talks. Egypt has proposed a two-day pause in fighting and the release of four hostages. The French actor Gérard Depardieu is due to appear in court today in Paris on charges of sexually assaulting two women during a film shoot in 2021. The 75-year-old has been accused of sexual offences by several women, but this is the first case to go to trial. He denies the charges. And Donald Trump has addressed supporters at one of the biggest rallies of his presidential campaign at Madison Square Garden in New York. He told them that he would end inflation if he won the election next week and promised to deport millions of migrants on day one of his administration. His Democratic rival, Kamala Harris, has been campaigning in the battleground state of Pennsylvania.
Charles, thanks very much. At 25 to 7, let's turn our attention to the politics of the day, because the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, is giving a speech in which he'll say that Britain must embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality in a bid to prepare the ground for the much-trailed budget on Wednesday. I'm joined by our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman. Henry, working people then, in terms of who's going to pay this tax, it's been tricky to define, it seems, but cause questions around whether manifesto pledges have been broken. Take us to where we're up to.
I think what's really interesting about the decision by Keir Starmer to give this speech is you are getting the why of the budget before we actually get the specifics on the what, which will come on Wednesday from Rachel Reeves. Some of the language that we've heard from this speech that Keir Starmer will give in the West Midlands later today, really striking indeed. It's time we ran towards the tough decisions. He'll say, if we do grasp the nettle on our economy, then we won't just get through this. Better days are ahead. I don't think that is the language, the rhetoric of the Prime Minister who thinks that all of these budget measures are going to be popular. And we're pretty familiar with what a lot of them are going to be now. Up to £40 billion of tax rises and spending cuts. We know there is going to be an increase in employer national insurance contributions. I'm told, by the way, that there are likely to be exemptions or mitigations, at least for some small businesses. That will be interesting to watch. We know there are likely to be changes to inheritance tax, potentially capital gains tax. So little wonder, perhaps, that Keir Starmer wants to preempt some of the criticism and explain why he believes he has to make those tough decisions.
And the front pages of some of the papers today, and many of the headlines, don't centre on this at all. They centre on a different story in the Labour Party, because it's had to suspend so far one of its MPs, Mike Amesbury, MP for Runcorn and Helsby, after footage emerged of him appearing to punch a man in the face in the wee hours of Sunday morning and then punch him five more times as he lay on the ground. It's shocking footage.
It really is. I mean, we've heard a lot in recent weeks about this government trying to improve its media management grid, but there's not a lot that a government can do to legislate for this sort of thing. Mike Amesbury is 55 years old. He became an MP in 2017 after more than a decade on Manchester City Council. He's been on the shadow front bench on and off, was a shadow minister actually in the run-up to the general election, but was among the two dozen or so that Keir Starmer passed over and didn't make actual ministers when Labour entered government. I mean, this footage is very damaging indeed for him. You can see him knock a man to the ground with one punch before hitting him a further five times while he's on the ground. He's been interviewed voluntarily by Cheshire Police under caution. The footage, we're told, took place about 2:15 in the early hours of Saturday morning. Labour have suspended his membership. He now is an independent MP in the House of Commons. Obviously, he will have a chance to give his side of story to the police. But quite a lot of people I was speaking to in Labour last night were wondering whether Mike Amesbury will be an MP much longer.
Henry Zefferman, our chief political correspondent. Thank you. And we'll return to the budget later with a member of the cabinet, Pat McFadden, to get some more detail on what is being talked about around that table and I suppose whether it will work or not.
22 minutes to 7. The heads of the CIA and Israeli intelligence are to take part in fresh talks hosted by Qatar and aimed again at a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza. At the moment, Israeli strikes and fighting with Hamas is all continuing. Yolande Nel, our correspondent, joins us from Jerusalem. First, on the latest from on the ground in Gaza, what do we know, Yolande?
I mean, the real focus over the weekend, Israel's sort of intensification of military actions, particularly in the north of the Gaza Strip. Of course, that's where it began, this new ground offensive earlier this month, saying it was they were regrouping Hamas fighters. It was rooting them out. I mean, details are very hard for us to verify, but Israeli strikes at the weekend, including in a residential block in Beit Lahia, Jabalia refugee camp, a school turned shelter in Gaza City, have killed dozens more Palestinians, footage suggesting that there are small children among those who have been killed. And we had very strong comments coming from the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres talking about how the plight of civilians in the north was unbearable and that war was being waged with little regard for international humanitarian law, saying he was shocked by the harrowing levels of death, injury and destruction in the north.
And then at the same time, we have these talks in Doha. We've had so many attempts and some of them seem to be close to getting a ceasefire and then it was all very elusive. Is there something different about what's happening now?
I mean, there has been this sort of general suggestion that the killing of Yahya Sinwar, mastermind of the 7th of October attacks, and somebody, you know, who was as leader of Hamas in Gaza before and then overall leader, seemed to be really calling the shots regarding ceasefire and hostage release deals, that from the Palestinian side, that his killing could open up, you know, a new opportunity for talks. We've already got the Mossad director in Doha to meet the Qatari prime minister, the CIA director as well. And, you know, Hamas hasn't sent a representative along, but reports suggesting it might do so moving forward to take part in these indirect negotiations. And we've had this Egyptian proposal that's quite intriguing to have a small number of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners released amid a sort of brief pause in the fighting to try to almost as a kind of gesture to try to get things going. Israel may want to test the ground, it's suggested in the media here, as the Hamas decision-making process is unclear after Yahya Sinwar was killed.
Yolande, thanks very much.
At 19 minutes to 7, to a different story entirely, but to look at perhaps what we don't know around how people smuggling works. A prolific people smuggler who's now in the UK and trying to claim asylum himself has been talking to the BBC about the forgery and fraud he deploys to smuggle people from Vietnam to reach Europe and this country. Andrew Harding is our correspondent. Andrew, good morning. What have you been able to find out?
Morning, Emma. So this is a man who, as you say, is currently in the UK, but he spent his life essentially in the smuggling industry, first working on the coast in northern France and more recently back in Vietnam, working as a forger for people from Vietnam who want to get into the UK, many of them through the European Union. And what he does is he provides forged documents. You know, if you have to apply to a, you know, a complicated visa regime and you need to prove proof of funds, income and so on. Well, he forges those documents, often with the help of corrupt banking officials. The reason we got into this story is that the Vietnamese have suddenly emerged as the biggest number of people this year crossing the channel in small boats. And we wanted to understand a bit more about why. We focused a lot on the Iraqi gangs who are actually managing the crossings, those small boats themselves. But we wanted to understand the kind of networks that are channeling people through these vast migration networks across Europe to reach Dunkirk, Boulogne and so on. And the Vietnamese are an interesting one because they are paying often double what other nationalities are paying to essentially jump the queue and get on these small boats. And they have a very sophisticated, organized network from the forgers in Vietnam through Hungary often or Poland to Paris and then on to the coast.
Andrew Harding, thank you.
Let us turn to the papers at 17 minutes to 7. Let's start, in fact, with the Mail, because that is the paper which obtained the video, or at least the second video, the CCTV video of the Labour MP, Mike Amesbury, and it has a still from it on its front page. It says it the incident happened at 2:15 a.m. This was Friday night into Saturday morning, and it says that the Labour MP was caught on camera punching a man in the street. The still or a version of it, that and from another video, is also makes the front page of the Telegraph and the Times. Mr. Ames reissued a statement saying he'd been threatened. He also said he'd referred himself to the police. But Labour initially said the incident was a matter for the police until the second video shared online showed the CCTV image of Mike Amesbury apparently punching a man and including continuing to punch him when he was on the ground. So that's the background to what Labour has had to do in suspending him and removing the whip from him.
And looking across the other front page stories on the Times, it says prepare to face reality in budget. This is what Keir Starmer is going to be talking about in his speech a little bit later on this morning. And the Mirror has an interview here with Keir Starmer. My pledge, we will make you better off, as he tells the nation to judge Labour in 5 years. Excuse me, he's writing in the Daily Mirror today. But an interesting poll as well on the front page of The Eye, and we'll get to this with Pat McFadden, member of the Cabinet, just after 8 o'clock, about trust in politicians. There is some evidence in a poll here that some voters have grown more cynical since the election, with more than three quarters of people polled saying they now believe politicians are out for themselves and whether politicians can actually drive change. So some insights there about how people are feeling ahead of what is an incredibly consequential moment for the new government, the budget, on Wednesday.
Now, it's more than a month since the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon and the bombing campaign, which Israel says is targeting Hezbollah. Lebanese authorities and civil society organisations are struggling to cope with the impact on the population. And the war is also laying bare tensions between communities and attitudes to Shia Muslims, the group from which Hezbollah, which is a political party as well as an armed group, has traditionally commanded support. Jonathan Hepburn.
Sometimes the pressure of living under non-stop bombardment just boils over. These are Lebanese Shia Muslims, uprooted by the airstrikes and now being evicted from a building where they'd sought shelter in Beirut's Hamra district. They hurl bins, boxes, anything they can at the riot police. Lebanon is absorbing hundreds of thousands of newly displaced people, and this risks reopening old sectarian divisions.
I've come to Hamra, to the place where the clash with the police happened. Lots of people just standing around looking very jumpy and nervous. And I'm outside the building where dozens of Shia families displaced by the bombing moved a few weeks ago. It was empty then. Now they've been given just 48 hours to leave. So this is a very bare entrance hall to what must have been quite a grand building, but it's very run down now, and it's packed full of people. So we're just looking into one of the rooms in this building.
Yes, you want this room?
Yes, very small for you. How many people here?
Eight
people.
We are 8 people.
One man, a father of five from Beirut's southern Dahia neighbourhood, says the landlady wants them out because they are Shia.
If she accepts to pay rent, we already can pay rent, but she didn't accept.
She wants you to go?
She wants to go. It's not only about the building, it's something else. I think, and this is my opinion, okay? She wants to kill the Muslim here.
The Shia.
Exactly.
Sara Al-Sharif has been helping IDPs in the northern city of Tripoli, which has been taking in large numbers of them.
People who have very little have shared with the newcomers, have welcomed them with open arms. However, people are worried about the Israeli army targeting their neighborhoods, claiming that certain wanted individuals are present among the IDPs. Moreover, they're afraid of potential long-term squatting, as has happened in the past.
So we've walked into quite a number of shops here. This is a very old retail district in Beirut, mixed but not Shia. And although people are very nervous of Israeli bombing, they also don't want to talk about any tensions with the displaced people.
I can't tell you everything. We must be careful, because we have some people like Iran, like Hezbollah. You know, I respect the Shia people, but now Hezbollah, he wants to steal Lebanon.
The street seller said he worries that some of the incomers might be affiliated with a political organization, by which he meant Hezbollah, making them a possible target of an Israeli airstrike. But he didn't want to say more. Some of the shops, though, were pleased with the extra customers they were getting.
Business has been good lately. All the displaced people are buying new clothes, new stuff. Of course, they didn't bring stuff with them. But it's also tragic what happened. They're living in schools or on the streets. It's not good.
It's not good either for the father of five, now facing an eviction order from the building he's made his home for the past 3 weeks.
What we can do? And now, today, we have 48 hours to leave it.
And where will you go?
I don't know. Maybe I will back to Dahi.
That's not safe.
If I will die like that, I will die like man. I will back to my home.
It's 11 minutes to 7. To come back to something that is expected to happen on Wednesday in the budget, come back to UK politics. The Chancellor is set to scrap the £2 cap on bus fares in her first budget on Wednesday, because apparently it's financially unsustainable. But what of those who rely on the bus services and are already struggling with the cost of daily life? Or is it another tough choice and a tough budget, as the government would probably put it? Sylvia Barrett is the Director of Policy and Campaigns, Campaign for Better Transport, and she's been telling us why this has been an important cap for many.
It has really helped with the cost of living. We have had some supporters who have saved about £100 a month, so they haven't had to think about whether they can afford to take the bus that month. And half of the people who are aware of the cap have made more journeys because of it, so it's really attracting more people to use the buses, which is really what we want because of the environment and health. We think there needs to be a full review about what should replace it, such as a mix of fare promotions and concessions.
Listening to that is Bill Hiron, chairman of the bus company Eastern Transport Holdings. Do you agree with the removal of this cap? It's good for business, I suppose, but difficult for those struggling.
Morning, Emma. Well, the challenge for the industry is that we've said to both the previous government and to this government, whilst accepting that the fare cap has to go at some point, initially that was going to be 3 months, then 6 months and so on, and it's been extended for 2 years now, what we don't want is a return to normal fares overnight, because, of course, people will forget that they used to pay, in some cases, £5, £6, £7 for their journey. £2 will have become the normal fare. So an overnight increase from £2 to whatever it might be is such a big jump that not only will it cause hardship for some people, but of course, it'll result in some people saying, I'm not going to take the bus anymore. I'm going to find another way of travelling.
Which is hugely problematic, both in rural areas especially, and also when we think about things like the climate, but just for people being able to get about. But are you able to reassure people that fares will not quadruple if this cap is lifted?
I don't think we can. Obviously, the reduction in fares wasn't fourfold in a lot of cases. In some urban areas, for example, fares were in some cases not much more than £2 anyway. So those fares are not going to suffer
a dramatic
increase.
No, but where they weren't.
But where they were high, in the intervening 2 years, of course, inflation and bus industry costs have whizzed away. And so actually the real fare now for some of those journeys is in most cases higher than it was 2 years ago.
So are you preparing for fewer passengers then, even if it comes in, as you say, slowly, that rise? That surely will be a reality because people are struggling with the cost of living.
I think if it comes in slowly, there is a much greater chance for people to adapt. If it goes from, say, £2 to £2.50 for a bit and then maybe to £3,
if they haven't got any more money, how are they going to adapt?
If there's no... Sorry, the people or the government?
The people.
the people. Well, it's not a desirable outcome. We all knew that the £2 fare cap was a short-term measure to help with the cost of living. So I think everyone understood it was going to go back up at some point. But as I say, what we don't want is a dramatic increase overnight.
No, I understand that. Are you doing anything to improve the bus services then? Are people going to get anything more for their money? Are the buses going to arrive on time? Are they going to be any better for this increase?
Over the intervening years, there's been all sorts of improvements in services all across the country. So post-COVID, generally frequencies have gone up. Investment in new and cleaner vehicles has ramped up again. Where we've worked in partnership with local authorities, with bus priority and so on, reliability has got better.
Okay, well,
so,
Bill, yes, we're going to have to leave it there, but the start of a conversation. Bill Hiron, Chairman of the Eastern Transport Holding Groups, thank you.
6:56. Georgia's president has called for people to protest outside Parliament today after parliamentary elections on Saturday that appear to have resulted in the ruling Georgian Dream Party being re-elected. The president, who is seen as pro-Western, says they were a falsification. Exit polls had suggested four opposition parties had won. Georgian Dream is seen as close to Moscow. Well, Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, is in Tbilisi in Georgia for these elections. What's the evidence from international observers about how credible this result is, Steve?
Well, international observers gave a press conference yesterday. They stopped short of using the kind of language that the Georgian opposition has used. They didn't talk about a fraudulent election or a stolen election, but they did report widespread vote violations, for example, ballot box stuffing, physical assaults on election observers, intimidation of voters. We actually, on Saturday, on the day of the election, talked to an opposition official who had gone to a polling station outside Tbilisi to investigate reports of vote violations. He was beaten up by 10 men at a polling station. That was caught on camera, and he was taken to hospital. So this kind of thing has been happening. But as I say, international observers have stopped short of declaring it neither free nor fair. Mm.
But the Georgian president has been very clear about her view, hasn't she? Do you think that people will heed her call to come out and protest? Because there were those large street protests earlier this year when a law that was seen as a Russia-style law was being proposed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, the Georgian president has made it clear in her belief this was a totally falsified election. She's spoken of it as a Russian special operation, hybrid warfare. She doesn't recognise it. As for those protests earlier in the year, yes, huge crowds came onto the streets of Tbilisi to protest against the foreign agents law, which was seen as an undemocratic, repressive piece of legislation. They failed to pressure the government then. They failed to pressure Georgia Dream into shelving it. So it's hard to imagine now, even if there is a huge crowd of protesters this evening on the square, it's hard to imagine Georgian Dream saying, OK, we put our hands up, we're going to annul the results of the election. I think that's not going to happen.
Are there close links between Georgian Dream and President Putin?
It's really interesting because many people describe Georgian Dream as pro-Russian, pro-Kremlin, pro-Putin. And yet the party itself still continues to claim that it's pro-EU, that its aim is still to join the European Union. And interestingly, who's coming today to Georgia? Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary. He's coming for a two-day visit, which says two really interesting things. One about Orban, that he doesn't mind how much controversy he causes with Brussels. I mean, very controversial coming to Georgia amid all this contested election. But it says something interesting about Georgian Dream, too. I think Georgian Dream does want to join the EU, but a different kind of EU, a more conservative EU, a sort of a Europe of nation states, which is less integrated, where Brussels has less control, the kind of EU that I think Viktor Orban would like, and actually the kind of EU that Moscow, I think, would prefer to deal with.
Steve Rosenberg, thank you.
Tomorrow night, there is something here on Radio 4 to get you ready for Halloween.
Uncanny, with me, Danny Robbins, returns to Radio 4 with more first-hand stories that defy explanation.
My arm was hairy and the clothing wasn't the clothes that I put on that day. It was deeply unsettling.
Mysterious presences.
I can't think of what would cause potentially an untold number of people to repeatedly see a woman in red.
And enigmatic experiences.
There was a poltergeist case in a council house, and the family found it so difficult to live with that they complained to the council about it, who reduced their rent.
An uncanny trilogy of terror, beginning tomorrow night at 11 on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
Here, though, we have the weather for you with Matt Taylor.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Good morning. It's a pretty mild start to the new working week and a mild week ahead for many. Temperatures out there at the moment in parts of North Wales and North East England around 15 degrees. One thing it is, though, for many is grey too. Across England and Wales, lots of cloud around this morning. Grey, damp start. Outbreaks of rain or drizzle will come and go for just about anyone this morning. The odd heavier burst now working into parts of Western Wales, western parts of Devon and Cornwall as well. Into the afternoon, though, the rain should become a bit lighter and patchier, some places staying completely dry through the afternoon as well, and a greater chance of a few cloud breaks. Not going to promise many, but best chance probably around parts of Cheshire, northwest Midlands, northeast England, also Kent and Sussex. As for Scotland, Northern Ireland, again here fairly grey and cloudy to get your new week underway. Rain or drizzle much lighter and patchier than it is across England and Wales, so a greater chance that more of you will stay dry through the day. And certainly into the afternoon, the sky should brighten a touch. Best of the weather throughout, though, will be across Orkney and Shetland. Some sunny spells here, but the odd brighter break possible elsewhere during the second half of the day. Temperatures across the country, well, in northern Scotland, 9 to 12 degrees, but for most, above where we should be for this stage in October, at a mild 14 to 17. And that's even with a bit of a breeze blowing across England and Wales. Stays mild tonight at 9 to 13 degrees, but cloudy and damp too.
Matt, thanks very much, and thank you to you for listening. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Emma Barnett.
It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 28th of October. The headlines. Sir Keir Starmer will say it's time to embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality in a speech he makes today ahead of the budget. The MP, Mike Amesbury, has been suspended from Labour after a video appeared to show him punching a man to the ground. Fresh talks about a Gaza ceasefire are taking place in Qatar. Here, we'll talk to a former Israeli Prime Minister and a former Palestinian Foreign Minister about the peace plan they're putting forward together.
Also coming up in the programme, so don't go anywhere. Are the rich really going to leave the UK, speaking of going somewhere, because of those expected tax rises in the budget? We'll talk to the Pimlico Plumbers boss, Charlie Mullins, who is apparently planning to leave, dividing time between Spain and Dubai, and Dale Vince, the founder of Ecotricity and a big Labour donor, and Charlie was a former Conservative donor, and he thinks that people who are unhappy, those rich individuals who've spoken about this, should leave the UK. So that's to come. A Democrat strategist tells us about jitters in the Harris campaign as Election Day approaches.
Well, we are professional hand wringers here in the Democratic Party. Everyone is having minor freakouts, but that's just what we do.
And a bit later on, we'll hear about an exhibition that celebrates one of the most remarkable and influential women from the Middle Ages.
She wrote so much music. She had so much to say.
You'll have to find out who that is, and what we're talking about. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
Sir Keir Starmer will prepare the ground for the budget with a speech this morning in which he'll say that Britain must embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality. The Chancellor's statement on Wednesday is expected to be one of the most significant in recent history, with tax rises and spending cuts worth tens of billions of pounds. The Conservatives have accused Sir Keir of running a government of broken promises. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
The Prime Minister will say it's time we ignored the populist chorus of easy answers and were realistic about where we are as a country. In a speech in the West Midlands, Sir Keir Starmer will attempt to frame what he admits will be a difficult budget in the context of what he calls the harsh light of fiscal reality. He will argue the country faces the unprecedented challenge of weak public finances alongside crumbling public services, and he'll promise to run towards what he calls the tough decisions. The Chancellor is expected to increase taxes by billions of pounds, as well as change the rules around debt to allow more borrowing for longer-term infrastructure projects. But senior Labour MPs have told me of their concern about the gloomy warnings ahead of the budget, as well as fears councils and prisons are among areas that could miss out on extra funding. In an attempt to address those worries, the Prime Minister will claim better days are ahead as he pledges to make Britain better off.
The Office for Budget Responsibility has defended its decision to publish on the same day as the budget a report on what the government says is a black hole in the public finances inherited from the last Conservative administration. The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has written to the OBR expressing significant concern about the timing. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
In his letter to the OBR, Jeremy Hunt said its decision to publish its review at the same time as the budget would be seen as a political intervention. He's concerned that the timing is designed to make the case that tax rises are the result of a black hole in the last government's spending forecasts, which the OBR was not told about at the time. Last night, the OBR said the review was about its institutional relationship with the Treasury, not the conduct or decisions of ministers. During his time in office, Mr. Hunt was a notable supporter of the OBR, saying the Truss administration's decision to sideline the forecaster was the biggest reason for the crisis caused by the mini-budget 2 years ago. The current Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, told the BBC last week that what she called the £22 billion black hole was one of the reasons tax rises were needed, and the OBR would be publishing its review on how that was allowed to happen.
The MP Mike Amesbury has been suspended from the Labour Party after footage emerged appearing to show him punching a man. Cheshire Police said a 55-year-old man had been interviewed voluntarily under caution following the incident in Frodsham in the early hours of Saturday. Mr. Amesbury has said he felt threatened. Graham Satchell reports.
This new video appears to show Mike Amesbury punching a man in the street. Two men are shown exchanging words. Then the Labour MP hits the man in the jaw and knocks him to the ground. The footage acquired by the Daily Mail then shows Mr. Amesbury apparently punching the man a further five times while he's on the floor before members of the public intervene. Mr. Amesbury has now been voluntarily interviewed under caution by Cheshire Police and released pending further inquiries. In a statement, Labour said Mike Amesbury's membership of the party had been suspended pending an investigation. It means he can't attend party meetings or take part in internal votes while the inquiry is ongoing. He's also lost the whip, so will not sit as a Labour MP during this period. The MP for Runcorn and Helsby hasn't responded to requests for comment. On social media, he said he'd felt threatened before the incident, had reported it to the police himself, and would cooperate with their inquiries.
Oil prices have tumbled after Israel's airstrikes on Iran in the early hours of Saturday targeted military installations and not oil facilities. Prices were down nearly 5% in early trading. They'd risen last week because of concern about the likely scale of Israel's response to the Iranian missile attack at the start of the month. Negotiations about a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of hostages being held there by Hamas are due to take place in Qatar. The Qatari Prime Minister is expected to meet Israeli and US intelligence chiefs. Egypt, which mediates between Israel and Hamas, has proposed an initial two-day pause in fighting and the release of four hostages. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, reports from Jerusalem.
Talks seeking a comprehensive, phased ceasefire in Gaza have repeatedly stalled, but many see Israel's killing of the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar earlier this month as having created a new opportunity to make progress on a deal. Israel says that meetings in Doha will look at the various possibilities to restart negotiations for the release of dozens of hostages still held by Hamas. While Hamas is not taking part, many of its leaders are based in Qatar. In an effort to break the deadlock in talks, Egypt has proposed a two-day truce during which four hostages would be freed. The plan also includes the release of some Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, the delivery of desperately needed humanitarian aid to Gaza, and 10 days of negotiations on a permanent ceasefire.
Police Scotland says the number of rape allegations has risen by almost 20% in a year. 1,400 alleged rapes were recorded between April and September this year. 550 of the offences were alleged to have happened over a year ago. A prolific people smuggler has told BBC News about the forgery and fraud used to help migrants from Vietnam to reach Europe and the UK. This year, more Vietnamese people have crossed the channel in small boats than any other nationality. Our correspondent Andrew Harding spoke to the smuggler, who now lives in the UK.
The man spoke to us on condition that we keep his identity confidential. He provided details to us about his work forging fake documents, things like bank statements and payslips, For Vietnamese people applying for visas to get to Europe, once in the EU, many of them head to the French coast, where Vietnamese gangs arrange for crossings by small boats to the UK.
It's a very lucrative business. If you have a good reputation, the clients come to you. No force, no violence.
How do you justify what you do here? You've come to the UK illegally. You're still breaking the law by assisting other people to come here illegally.
I just do paperwork. I help people to travel. I don't force them to take certain routes.
The man denied trafficking people to the UK to work for criminal gangs. As part of our investigation, we contacted a different Vietnamese people smuggler in northern France who offered our undercover reporter a place on a small boat for £2,600. The smuggler promised a safe trip, despite the fact that more than 50 people have already drowned in the Channel this year.
With 8 days to go until polling day in the US presidential election, Donald Trump has held one of the largest rallies of his campaign. He told supporters at Madison Square Garden in New York that he would end inflation and deport millions of migrants if he won. Mr. Trump was born in New York, but the state has not backed a Republican presidential candidate for 40 years. Our senior North America correspondent Gary O'Donoghue was at the rally.
Donald Trump walked off stage to Frank Sinatra's New York, New York. And during his speech, he sang all the old familiar tunes on the economy, on inflation and on immigration. He promised once again to deport millions of migrants on day one of his administration. And he said any migrant who killed an American should get the death penalty.
I will rescue every city and town that has been invaded and conquered. And we will put these vicious and bloodthirsty criminals in jail. Going to kick them the hell out of our country as fast as possible.
As he enters the final week of campaigning, there is little to choose between him and Kamala Harris in those key swing states that will decide the outcome.
O'Donoghue.
Thanks very much, Charles. It's 7:10. And if you cast your mind back to the general election campaign, if you listened in to hear on the Today programme across the BBC, a regular voice was Paul Johnson, director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and he kept asking how Labour, if it were to win power, would be able to stick to its manifesto pledge and not raise taxes on working people. Who exactly working people are has proved elusive at times to the government in the last few days, but ahead of the budget on Wednesday, in which the Chancellor is expected to increase employers' national insurance contributions, I can talk to Paul again. Paul, good morning.
Morning.
I don't suppose you like doing told you so's in any way, but is there a slight element of that? I recognise this is a serious situation, but where are you as we go towards this budget on that front?
Well, it's a little frustrating, isn't it? Because one heard the senior politicians from both sides continually saying that there wasn't this fiscal problem and taxes wouldn't really have to go up and growth would source it all. But I think everybody knew that there was a big problem with the public finances, and we'd either have to get tax cuts or tax increases or significant spending cuts. And lo and behold, we're being told that, you know, that has now been discovered, and it looks like we're going to get something like 40 billion of tax increases, if the briefing is to be believed, and that would make this one of the biggest tax raising budgets ever.
Are you frustrated by what some have described as artful wordplay from the politicians, where, for instance, yesterday the education secretary wouldn't say that somebody who owned a business and took a net profit of 13,000, which is the average for small businesses, was a working person?
Well, I think this reference to working people or taxes not affecting working people is, well, let's say, not helpful. I mean, I literally can't think of any tax that doesn't affect people who work. Normal use of the English language would suggest that people who work are working people. I think what is implied or intended or meant by this is probably something more similar to what, from recollection, Theresa May called the squeeze middle, and maybe Ed Miliband called the struggling something or other. this, I suspect, really refers to people on average kinds of incomes, and that's obviously a perfectly reasonable group to want to try to protect. But most of us are working people or have been working people, and even if you put taxes on employers, in the end, it is working people who pay that, because there's really no one else there to pay.
A point that the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King was talking about this weekend, he said on Sky News, the debate about putting up taxes on working people was a terrible illusion. Taxes are paid by people, to your point. Have you got any idea, Paul, though, if we were to use the front bench's definition of a working person, of how many people who aren't deemed working people will be paying these increases in taxes? If we talk about those who own property, who have some shares, who perhaps have savings, who pay some capital gains taxes, we're not talking here just about, we will be hearing from them a bit later in the programme, the super rich here. Any idea of how many millions, is it millions of people?
Well, again, it obviously depends what happens. I mean, capital gains tax is paid actually by a very, very small number of people, about 0.5% of the adult population each year. And most of them are paid by, most capital gains are paid by about 10 or 15,000 people a year. So very, very tiny numbers. Of course, there are several million people who are self-employed or small business owners, most of whom are on terribly high incomes, but actually the self-employed will be those least affected by increases in employer national insurance contributions. In fact, they will effectively benefit relative to people in work unless their national insurance contributions are increased. So it really does depend on how you define this. But again, going by the briefing, it may well be bizarrely enough that the self-employed and small business owners may be less affected than people in work, as I say, unless their taxes are raised in the same way that employer national insurance but is going to be raised. That's a very big tax rise, which will effectively only impact working people.
And just to explain that, because, again, we've heard from cabinet ministers over the weekend saying if you have a payslip, you will not be paying more tax on it. How will you be paying more then if you are employed?
Well, you won't directly be paying more, but if your employer is paying higher national insurance contributions, we know both sort of the theory tells you this, but also we know empirically, we know from analysis of data of what's happened in the past, that if employer national insurance contributions go up in the longer term or the medium term, that is passed through to people who are in work, either in lower pay than they would otherwise have, or potentially in a smaller number of jobs. I mean, that is just kind of obvious in a sense. But you're right, it won't appear in the payslip as a higher level of tax.
Paul Johnson, we will hear from Pat McFadden a bit later, just after 8 o'clock, to hear some of the thinking from that that cabinet table ahead of the budget.
It is now 7:15. The plight of Palestinian civilians trapped in North Gaza is unbearable, the UN Secretary General has said, as an intense Israeli offensive against Hamas continues. On Saturday's programme, we heard this from Saeb, who is a Palestinian in Gaza, whose story we've been following.
The last 15 to 20 days, like, so hard, especially at the Jabalia neighborhood. We came here, like, we feel so scared just hearing the voices of the bombing and the rockets that they throw over there. We are so scared. We can feel that they are getting closer to us.
We're joined now from Gaza by Rosalia Bollin, who is from UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency. Good morning, Rosalia, to you. What can you tell us about your ability to reach children in these very difficult parts of Gaza?
Good morning. UNICEF, just like other humanitarian organizations, faces massive impediments when it comes to reaching especially the north of Gaza. So intense bombardments and attacks have escalated dramatically this month in the two governorates in the north, after the IDF issued displacement orders on the 6th of October for Gaza and North Gaza. And that means that tens of thousands of people again are being displaced. We have hospitals that are being raided. We had, UNICEF has counted 37 schools turned shelters in northern Gaza that have been hit or shelled this month. Hospitals are evacuating, and that is only intensifying a local healthcare crisis. We have families facing shortages of basic supplies of electricity, of fuel. They can't feed themselves and their children. And as to our access, the decline in our access has just been catastrophic. And that's tragic, because until recently, we actually had fairly good access to the north. But over the past couple of weeks, humanitarian missions are largely being denied. And similarly, no commercial goods have been able to get into the north. And that is extremely, extremely worrying. We are looking at a risk of man-made famine due to this surge in violence and the near blockade of supplies, you know.
And this time frame, yes, I just want to ask you about this time frame you're talking about, the last couple of weeks, because we are 2 weeks on from the 15th of October, which is when the Biden administration told Israel to take steps within 30 days to improve the dire humanitarian conditions in Gaza. Has anything changed for the better in the last 2 weeks since the administration said that?
Well, what I would like to impress on all your listeners this morning is really the gravity of the situation now across Gaza, but specifically in the north. Honestly, we have never been more concerned about what the future holds. And what we are seeing is this escalating violence and just extreme difficulties to bring supplies in. And children are paying the highest price for that. There's considerable risk of malnutrition increasing because of the lack of supplies. You know, UNICEF, we can bring in nutrition supplies, we can bring in therapeutic food, but that is not going to be sufficient. Children need food, they need supplies. At scale, they need diversity in their diets. And for that, we need the commercial sector, we need private entities, the private sector, to bring in food items, hygiene items, sanitary items at scale.
Okay. From what you're saying, it sounds as if things have got worse in the last 2 weeks rather than better in any way. Would that be accurate?
In the north, certainly things continue to deteriorate. Currently, I have two colleagues, a health expert and a water sanitation and hygiene expert, that are part of an assessment mission. It's a larger humanitarian assessment mission to Gaza City. And what they've been sending me voice notes, and what they describe is just beyond imagination. So besides the tens of thousands of people on the move, they visited hospitals in Gaza City that are without supplies. They've seen that most of the children go around barefoot. Children are covered in dirt. Children are hungry. They have skin diseases. They have rash. One of my colleagues entered Sahaba Hospital and he saw a premature baby that was born just 2 hours earlier. The baby was born at 26 weeks. It didn't have a name yet, and it only weighed 1 kg. So very, very premature. The doctors had wrapped it in aluminium foil and tried as best as they could to keep it warm, but they need equipment. They need beds for neonatal care, incubators, that specialized care. Supplies is just not there.
Rosalia Bollin from UNICEF in Gaza, thank you.
It's 21 minutes past seven. Well, the Prime Minister is talking today about the budget and trying to strike a more optimistic but realistic tone ahead of it on Wednesday. It's business leaders who will need some of the most convincing, and Sean Farrington is back with more. Sean, hello.
Hi, Emma. Yeah, I've been at the Jamaican Patty Flake Bake Kitchen in Southeast London this morning, hearing the owners' concerns here. I'm joined now in the office, the back office, by Barry O'Dwyer, the chief executive of Royal London Group, which is the largest mutual pensions, life insurance and investment company in the UK, managing almost £170 billion of assets. And a lot of that will be investing in bonds, which can be seen as effectively lending money to the likes of the UK government. Barry, good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
Barry, just hearing, as we did an hour ago, about how the cost of government borrowing has been ticking up a little bit in the run-up to the budget. Why has that been happening?
I think this is the normal level of uncertainty you get just in advance of the budget. Until the markets hear what the Chancellor is actually proposing, then there's always a little bit of uncertainty.
So what's in the detail is creating that uncertainty at the moment? Why would interest rates be increasing because of what Rachel Reeves might say?
Well, we've heard obviously of the £22 billion black hole and then the £40 billion gap in government requirements. And so that's leading the markets to be uncertain about the level of tax rises that will be announced and how the Chancellor intends to pay back the money that she's borrowing, because that's crucial to the bond market.
Do you share the concerns of Jeremy Hunt, as we've heard this morning, the former Chancellor, about the Office for Budget Responsibilities publishing of a report that looks set to come this Wednesday that may well criticise the previous government and the financial situation it left this Labour government?
Well, I think from the perspective of me and the rest of the markets, it's all about the future now. I mean, we'll have to wait and see what the OBR publish, but that's largely a political consideration. I think we're more focused on how we go from here.
And what, for where you go from here, what are you looking from Rachel Reeves on Wednesday to give you the confidence, and the people who you manage money for, the confidence to put more money into the UK and to have more optimism? Because we just seeing this morning, business confidence has taken a hit in recent months.
Yeah, and I think that's linked to the doom and gloom around the black hole, etc. The thing is, markets can cope with bad news. What they don't really like is uncertainty. So what we'll be looking for is stability and certainty for the future laid out by the Chancellor after she delivers the bad news and tax rises.
And is there one thing that Rachel Reeves has to be careful of to not have those interest rates increase further? What will you be looking for?
I think it's basically just certainty that there is a plan to repay the money that's being borrowed on markets.
Okay, Barry O'Dwyer, Chief Executive of Royal London, thank you very much.
Sean, thank you. It is 24 minutes past seven. Donald Trump had a big and long rally in New York last night. He and Kamala Harris are fighting for every possible vote in these final 8 days of the race. He's also appeared on the Joe Rogan podcast, the biggest in the world, while Kamala Harris has decided not to. Democratic strategist Lindy Lee, who's been campaigning with the vice president, has been speaking to us.
I was just with her in Philadelphia today. She barnstormed the city, hitting up a number of spots, including a community center, which was where I met her. And then I'm going to join Obama and Bruce Springsteen tomorrow. They're doing a concert here at Temple University. So I'm not going to be with her tomorrow, but I will be with her again on Tuesday for the lip speech. I don't know if you guys heard about that. She's trying to remind Americans of the significance of January 6th. So she's going back to the location where Trump gave his, from my point of view, an incitement of violence to his supporters.
And is that because she thinks that is the best strategy at this point? She's not as far ahead as she would like to be. It seems she's lost some of her early momentum after she became the nominee. And that seems to be the best way to turn people away from him?
Well, I think it was always going to be very close, given the extreme political polarization of American society. You know, a 50-50, honestly, might have been the best we could hope for, given the fact that we have three fundamental issues running against Democrats. Number one is the economy and inflation. It's a very anti-incumbent environment. Number two is immigration and the spike in migrants that came across the border during the Biden administration. And number three was President Biden probably shouldn't have run at all. So it was a very truncated campaign. She only had 100 days to introduce herself to the American people.
Right. So she's suffering because it's an anti-incumbent campaign. But she's not the incumbent, is she? She came into the race at that time. It looked like she was something fresh despite being the vice president. And some of that seems to have gone away.
Yeah, but unfortunately, she's a vice president to the incumbent president. So in Americans' mind, she's essentially the status quo. So she's running as a change candidate despite being in office. So it's a very delicate dance. You know, it's hard to disentangle. And she hasn't really separated herself from President Biden out of loyalty. I mean, I respect that. But she only in recent days has she kind of, you know, opened up some daylight. We probably should have issued these immigration executive orders a little bit earlier. Maybe we shouldn't have sent out another stimulus check. These are just things that indicate that, no, she's not going to be Biden 2.0.
But do you think she should have done, it sounds as if you think she should have done more of that earlier. Are you worried about next Tuesday?
Well, we are professional hand-wringers here in the Democratic Party. Everyone is having minor freakouts, but that's just what we do. We're excellent at losing our minds over this, because everyone has PTSD over Trump in 2016.
I wonder if you think she should do the Joe Rogan podcast. It has, well, Donald Trump's just done it. It's got millions of listeners, many of them Trump voters.
Yeah, I spoke with members of her team about this. It's not going to happen, unfortunately. It's just not going to happen.
Why not?
Joe Rogan is, my guess is that Joe Rogan is firmly in the Trump camp. You know, they spoke for 3 hours yesterday. He's very much in MAGA world.
So do you mean that Joe Rogan has not invited Kamala Harris? She'd be willing to do it, but the opportunity is not there.
He would definitely do it. He would definitely do it.
Right, so she's decided not to.
Yes.
And do you think that's a mistake?
Well, I think it serves her better to reach out to those swing voters that are actually more pliable. You know, that's why she went to three different cities with former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, including here in Pennsylvania, where I am. And so the undecided voter is kind of like a unicorn at this point. Like, where are they? They're so few. So I think reaching out to those persuadable voters is a better use of her time, given that we have 8 days left, rather than going into the Joe Rogan experience world. These people are very much inclined to vote for Trump.
Lindy Lee, Democratic strategist. Thank you.
Yes, just days to go. It's 28 minutes past seven. Carthy's here with the sports news. Hi, Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. A quick look at the football headlines first. Arsenal are 5 points behind Premier League leaders Manchester City after a 2-2 draw with second place Liverpool yesterday. West Ham had a 2-1 win over Manchester United to keep the pressure on the United manager Erik ten Hag, and Celtic are back at the top of the Scottish Premiership after a 3-0 win over Motherwell. In Formula One, the British driver Lando Norris has cut Max Verstappen's championship lead to 47 points and labelled his rival dangerous after Verstappen was given a penalty for forcing Norris off the track in the Mexico City Grand Prix. Ferrari's Carlos Sainz won that race. Cricket now, and England's men lost their test series in Pakistan at the weekend and have a short turnaround to their next test series against New Zealand in November, while the England white ball squad start their series against West Indies this Thursday. To have a look at the impact of all of that, let's speak to the editor of the cricket annual Wisden. Good morning, Lawrence Booth. How relevant is the series defeat to Pakistan in those rather strange conditions with a used pitch there?
Yeah, England were trying to park that one a bit. They don't go back to Asia for a test series until early 2027 against Bangladesh. So they will say that the used pitch in Multan and then the attempts to sort of scuff up the pitch in Rawalpindi mean that it was a one-off. But I think the issue they face is really how they responded under pressure. And the answer was not very well. They went 1-0 up on a flat pitch. And then the first sign of the ball spinning, the old English Achilles heel came out, and they fell flat on their faces against Noman Ali and Sajid Khan, took 39 wickets out of 40 between them and really collapsed at the first hint of pressure. So that will occur again in New Zealand. They'll face difficult circumstances. They're going to have to respond better than they did in Pakistan.
Well, what can they learn then, England, from what happened in Pakistan, turning that attention already to New Zealand just a few weeks away?
I think one of the main issues they'll be facing is the captain, Ben Stokes. How engaged, how sort of on the ball is he? It was for the first time really in his test time as captain, he looked slightly passive in Pakistan, especially in the third test. He let the game drift when Saud Shakil and Pakistan's tail-enders extended Pakistan's first innings crucially. He played no shot famously in the second innings, LBW. That's a very un-Stokes thing to do. And he really sets the tone. We've seen that in the 2.5 years he's been as captain. I think he's a bit concerned about his fitness. He only bowled 10 overs in the second test, none at all in the third. Couldn't score a run. He was very disengaged when he spoke to the media afterwards. So a fit and firing Stokes, who's setting example, will be able to take England with him. But if he's not fully on it, then they may struggle again.
Yeah, and Brendan McCullum, the test coach, will also be the white ball coach as of next year. That would have been a tight turnaround for him. But is this the rebuilding, perhaps, of that side when they start the series this week, West Indies, at that one-day international series?
Yeah, it is to a degree. I mean, England hosted Australia at the end of September. You probably blinked and you missed it because there's so much other cricket going on. But the last 12 months, they've surrendered 2 World Cups, 50-over World Cup in India last year very badly, and then the T20 World Cup in the Caribbean in the summer when they were pretty abject as well. So this is a big chance for them. Marcus Dresgothick's the standing coach until McCullum takes over. Joss Butler is still injured, so Liam Livingstone will captain in the ODIs, which start on Thursday. But Dresgothick will really want 2 good series wins to hand over to McCullum when he takes a job going to India in the new year.
Yeah, all right. Lawrence Booth, editor of Wisden, thank you very much. I get over the jet lag from Pakistan. In the next hour, we will hear from the British tennis number one, Jack Draper, who has added his name to a list that includes Henman Rozetsky and Murray by winning the Vienna Open.
those guys are legends, you know, legends of British tennis, and to be a part of that group winning here in Vienna. So maybe I'll come back here and win more than they did here. So we'll see.
More from Jack Draper, the new world number 15, in the next hour.
Carthy, thank you.
Maths book. Pencil case. Oh, water bottle. I always forget that. Trainers. Calculator. Anxiety. I'll bury that at the bottom.
Some children carry more than others, but with our help, their mental health issues can feel lighter. BBC Children in Need. We're there for you.
Let's have a look now at the weather. Today will be largely cloudy across the UK, with patchy rain for England and Wales and bright spells in the northeast.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech today to warn of unprecedented economic challenges, but he'll say better days are ahead. The Prime Minister is expected to set the tone for the budget on Wednesday by saying that Britain needs to embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality. The Conservatives have accused the government of broken promises. The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, says the Office for Budget Responsibility has abandoned impartiality by deciding to publish on the same day as the budget a report about what the government calls the black hole in the public finances. Labour says it inherited the shortfall from the last Conservative administration. The OBR said the review was about its institutional relationship with the Treasury. The Labour Party has suspended the MP Mike Amesbury after footage emerged which appeared to show him punching a man. Cheshire Police said that a 55-year-old man had been interviewed voluntarily under caution and later released. Talks on a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal are due to take place in Qatar today. The Qatari Prime Minister will meet Israeli and US intelligence chiefs. Hamas is not taking part in the talks. Egypt has proposed a 2-day pause in fighting and the release of 4 hostages. A prolific Vietnamese people smuggler who entered the UK illegally has told the BBC he forges documents to enable other migrants from Vietnam to reach Europe. This year, more Vietnamese people have crossed the channel in small boats than any other nationality. The number of rape allegations recorded by police in Scotland is nearly 20% higher than in the same period last year. 1,400 alleged rapes were recorded between April and September this year. 550 of the offences were alleged to have happened over a year ago. And Donald Trump has addressed supporters at one of the biggest rallies of his presidential campaign at Madison Square Garden in New York. He told the audience he would end inflation if he won the election next week. His Democratic rival, Kamala Harris, has been campaigning in the battleground state of Pennsylvania.
Charles, thanks very much. It's 25 to 8. As you've been hearing in the bulletins, the single largest nationality represented in small boat crossings this year is people from Vietnam. And a BBC investigation has heard and has been able to share a first-hand account of how the trade that brings people to Europe takes place, first through forged documents such as bank statements and payslips. Andrew Harding reports.
We're heading down a muddy path in an area where there are, we know, hundreds of migrants camping out in the woods, in the forests. It's a clear, bright day, but it's been raining heavily. Little camps you can see all over, mostly in the undergrowth. It's very quiet now. Dozens of these tiny little one or two men igloo style tents. 3 shopping trolleys lying empty there. Clothes hanging on lines from the trees. Hello? Hello? Hello, sir. There's a man in a big tent here that he's hung up from a tree trunk. And he's just putting his shoes on to come out and see us. Do you speak some English?
Yeah.
No. The man is from Vietnam, a country that's emerged quite suddenly this year as the largest single source of people heading to Britain in small boats.
Are you aware that what you're trying to do here, this crossing to the UK, is incredibly dangerous and illegal?
Yes, I'm aware.
And that doesn't stop you?
No.
Why not?
I have no other choice. If I return to Vietnam, I have nothing there. I already sold my house.
but it wasn't enough to pay off my debt. I still owe £50,000.
As we move around the woods, several Vietnamese mention that the smugglers may be nearby. A lot of the gangs are armed. Violence is not uncommon.
Is it dangerous to talk about that sort of thing?
I don't think he's comfortable with us.
No, we'll leave you alone. We don't want to endanger you. We've managed to make contact by phone with one of the Vietnamese smugglers, but it turns out he's already in the UK, so I'm driving now to an undisclosed location somewhere in northern England to meet him in person. A translator is going to be speaking his words.
It's a very lucrative business. If you have a good reputation, the clients come to you. No force, no violence.
We'll call him Tan, a slim, neatly dressed man who crossed the channel in a small boat earlier this year. He spent most of his adult life in the smuggling business. We're keeping his identity confidential, the only way he'd agree to tell us about his work. He's now applying for asylum in the UK.
You told the British authorities you've been trafficked here, but that's not true, is it?
No, I was not trafficked here. I said I was, because that's just the way it's done. It's what you say in order to get asylum.
The police and human rights groups say that's nonsense, that many Vietnamese brought to the UK are victims of modern slavery. For some years, Tan worked for a smuggling gang in France, but he then went back to Vietnam, where he began forging documents for people trying to get visas to Europe.
I'm good at this work. People trust me. I never fail.
He's showing me here some of the documents that he's actually forged. He's got copies on his phone. One is for a bank statement. Another is for some pay slips. And this is a Hungarian visa, a genuine visa that one of his customers was given on the basis of his forged documents. How do you justify what you do here? You've come to the UK illegally. You're still breaking the law by assisting other people to come here illegally. At the same time, you're taking British taxpayers' money to be fed, to be sheltered here in the UK.
I just do paperwork. I help people to travel. I don't force them to take certain routes.
I think a lot of British people watching this will not buy that. They will say that you are a criminal and that you should hand yourself into the police.
The way I see it, I don't do anything illegal here in the UK. I'm not breaking the law here. I was only breaking Vietnamese law.
How long have we been in touch with this man?
10 days ago.
But back in France, the smuggling continues. To understand more about the shadowy Vietnamese operation there, we decide to go undercover. My colleague here, he has been posing as a Vietnamese migrant, and you've made contact with the smuggler, yeah?
Yeah, I did over the last 10 days or so.
And he thinks you're a migrant from Vietnam who's come through Europe, and you're now waiting to get on a small boat.
Yeah, sure. That's what I tried to convince him.
You say you found out about this smuggler online. Tell me a bit about that process.
It's quite open business. They advertise this quite frankly and openly on Facebook. They don't feel fear about that, and even they don't think that it's kind of the criminal at all.
And he's saying what?
He expects me to come to this area and then get in touch with him.
So you're going to have a face-to-face meeting, yeah?
I hope that I could see him sometime this afternoon.
Okay.
Bonjour. BBC.
Our team waits near a spot where other migrants gather for humanitarian aid. Our colleague, still posing as a migrant, calls the smuggler.
Em ơi, em đang đi đến đâu rồi?
He tells her to move away towards the woods through a broken fence. It's dangerous. And our colleague suddenly signals that she's not okay.
She wants to be rescued.
Okay, she wants out.
Come back. Are you okay?
Don't catch up with the guy, the blonde guy.
We get a glimpse of the smuggler, a tall figure now vanishing back into the woods. Our colleague is safe, but in similar circumstances, many others are not. Some forced, others willingly embarking on an increasingly dangerous voyage.
That's Andrew Harding reporting. He's also written a piece on the BBC News website about it, and we'll have more on that investigation in an hour's time.
It is now 22 minutes to 8. When Neil's Yard Dairy got a huge order for 22 tonnes of cheese, everyone thought it was good news, the company itself and its suppliers, but it turned out to be a con. The cheese was delivered, but the invoices were not paid, and it turned out the buyer was a fraudster. Patrick Holden is affected as one of the suppliers. Some of his Hafod Welsh cheddar was part of the heist, and he's on the line. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
What did you think when Neil's Yard first got in touch about a large order?
Well, we weren't entirely surprised. I mean, we've been dealing with Neil's Yard Dairy for 17 years, which is how long we've been making cheese. We're a small dairy farm, less than 100 cows, and we add value to the milk, which is produced organically by turning it into cheese. And we've got customers all over the place, but we were particularly happy that we had an order from France. We thought, you know, Coles to Newcastle, and we were quite excited. So it was, came as a tremendous shock when we found that actually this was theft, and it was a violation really, because we rely on trust and transparency right the way through to the people who eat our cheese. So this really was a bit of a violation.
Have you ever heard of a cheese fraud, a cheese heist of this kind? It does sound like it was incredibly sophisticated. They appear to have impersonated a well-known cheese buyer or cheese intermediary.
Yes, and they claim to be agents of a French supermarket. And not only that, but when Neil's Yard delivered the cheese, they took it to a warehouse on the outskirts of London, which broke the chain. So they were pretty sophisticated. And that made it all the more shocking, really, that this could happen to a product which is, you know, hallmarked by openness and trust and transparency all the way down from the producer to the final customer.
And presumably the cheese has disappeared from that location already.
Yes, it's been speculated it's gone to Russia or the Middle East or somewhere like that. We just don't know. But of course, they've already claimed £300,000, these criminals. And if they sell the cheese, they'll get more again. It's a sad story, but maybe it just is a wake up call for us all to learn more about the story behind our food, because I think these days we don't know very much about it.
How have you been paid for the cheese that you supplied?
Yes, Neil's Yard Dairy have helped us right through our cheese story from the outset, and they've honoured that. They said immediately they would pay and honour their commitment. So it's Neil's Yard Dairy that are taking the hit on this, and we need to be supportive of them because they're a fantastic company and they've really been brilliant to us. They come and grade our cheese 3 or 4 times a year. We're friends with them.
Will this change the way you do business, or do you think it'll change the way they do business? Is it often, or has it been based on trust, the cheese trade, to a large degree?
It has. The whole thing is based on trust, and I don't think it will change it. I mean, obviously, they're going to be a bit more cautious. But really, don't we want more trusted and transparent ways to get our food from the people who produce it? We're making cheese literally right across the yard from where I'm sitting now, and the people who eat it. I think that's what's disappeared in our modern food systems. We need to know more about the story behind our food. That should be our right. And people like Chris Van Tulleken have done a brilliant job to waking us up to what happens to it after it leaves the farm gate. But we need to know the story before the farm gate as well.
Patrick Holden, thank you very much.
And 7:45, do stay with us here on the programme to tell you one of the things coming up, one of the discussions. An Israeli and a Palestinian will be talking about their shared vision for a Middle East peace plan. But it's time now for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Michael Hurley, Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge.
Good morning. The formal convention for greeting someone used to be, how do you do? The appropriate reply being, how do you do? Don't actually explain how you're doing, in other words, and don't expect anyone to tell you how they're doing either. While this convention has more recently edged towards how are you, how are things, or even what's up, the etiquette remains substantially the same. By all means, respond with a perfunctory I'm fine, thanks, not too bad, or could be worse. Just don't make the mistake of thinking anyone really wants to have the full lowdown on your life. There's a wonderful short story called The Open Window, written by Saki in 1914, in which a young man violates this principle. Frampton Nuttall, we are told, was one of those people who laboured under the tolerably widespread delusion that total strangers and chance acquaintances are hungry for the least detail of one's ailments and infirmities. The story takes the form of an elaborate joke at Nuttall's expense, and we laugh along. But there is also, I think, a serious moral buried within it, about how we orientate ourselves in the world. On the one hand, our social media-saturated culture encourages us to curate a dishonest version of ourselves as endlessly happy and successful, even glamorous. On the other hand, most news reporting is dominated by negative narratives that can have the effect of exaggerating our sense of how awful everything is. There's not much to be done about social media, perhaps, other than to ration it and recognise it for what it is, but I was delighted to hear of an organisation called Positive News that has recently teamed up with an advertising company to share uplifting stories on billboards and digital platforms throughout the UK. Rather than focus on crises, conflicts and cruelty, Positive News harvests stories from around the world that highlight human resilience, innovation and kindness. That seems to me a good thing. Cultivating gratitude boosts mental health, studies show, but as the medieval friar Meister Eckhart once observed, being grateful may also be a form of prayer. In Eckhart's view, if the only prayer you ever say in your entire life is, "Thank you," it will be enough. Enough for God, that is, but perhaps for each of us too. And here's the kicker. A grateful outlook affects others as well. While total strangers and chance acquaintances are indeed unlikely to be hungry for all the details of our lives, good or bad, choosing to focus on what in your life you're thankful for can be compelling. Being grateful for what you have may help others to recognise their own blessings too.
That was Thought for the Day with Michael Hurley, Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge. It's 11 minutes to 8.
How can anyone think in terms of a Middle East peace plan when even a brief ceasefire has been impossible to achieve in Gaza so far? Nevertheless, the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has been working on one, alongside a former Palestinian foreign minister. Mr. Olmert spoke about it when he was part of the Last Today debate a few weeks ago, but he is now in London promoting the plan alongside Nasser al-Kidwa, who represented Palestinians at the UN for years before serving in the Palestinian Authority. And they're both with us in the studio, Ehud Olmert, Nasser al-Kidwa. Welcome.
Now, good morning.
You wrote about this in the Financial Times. You've written about it in the Washington Post as well. You've already been speaking about it at a conference in London. You say that what you've worked out together is an agreement that will put a final end to the violence between your two peoples. That will inevitably involve sacrifices and compromises. So I wonder first, Mr. al-Kidwa, what are Palestinians prepared to give up?
Well, yeah, we presented a proposal, not a comprehensive deal or a comprehensive plan. And we think that it's a very important proposal. It covers three very important issues. One, the war in Gaza and the necessity to cease the war and how we can do that, of course, in line with what was suggested by President Biden and what was incorporated in Security Council Resolution 2735. And the second thing is the overall political solution, the form of two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side on the basis of 1967 borders, etc., etc. Of course, there is a swap, 4.4%, that was presented by Mr. Olmert during his tenure. And finally, we proposed the something concrete about the future of Jerusalem. And, of course, we called on the people in office on both sides to continue negotiations and to reach a comprehensive deal. And that means agreeing on important things like settlement, settlers, yeah, refugees.
But do Palestinians give up what's like called the right of return, the right to go back to home?
We didn't get into that.
Pre-1967
Israel. We didn't get into that. As I told you, we call on people in office because we do understand that we are not in office. And as such, we have the responsibility of raising our voice and say what's happening is wrong and we need to change course and we need to go in the direction of talking, debating, and, of course, reaching an agreement on the final settlement. And that includes the issues that we proposed in addition to other issues as well.
Let me turn then to Mr. Olmert. The climate is so much harder in Israeli society on the question of peace than it was when you were in office. And I think that the big sacrifice, what Israel would give up under your vision, is almost all of the West Bank.
Yes, but this is something that I already proposed in 2008 and 2009 to the president of the Palestinian Authority, Dr. Mahmoud Abbas. Yes, there can be no peace, no change, without a separation between us and the Palestinians. And the only possible separation is by Israeli withdrawing from most of the areas that are occupied now for almost 60 years, which include the West Bank. The compromise that I proposed originally and the compromise that we reached, Dr. El-Kidwa and myself, although, of course, we are not in any formal position, but we are in a position of influence. Our voice is heard and is spread across the world, which is what we want, is that we will pull out from almost all of the territories and will annex 4.4% of the West Bank and equal-sized territory from what was part of the State of Israel prior to 67 will be swapped to the new Palestinian state. This is one compromise. The other, which I think is perhaps more significant, is that the Arab part of Jerusalem will be the capital of the Palestinian state. There is no reason that a Jabal Mukaber or Beit Hanina or Shoafat or other neighborhoods in the city of Jerusalem, which Arabic, will be part of the State of Israel. The third, which is even more significant, dramatic, but I say is the breakthrough that can make the agreement, is that the old city of Jerusalem will have no exclusive political sovereignty, neither Israeli nor Palestinian. If there will ever be one exclusive political sovereignty, there will never be peace.
That means Israel would give up sovereignty over the Western Wall.
The Western Wall will be part of Jerusalem with free access to all Israelis anytime, without any limitations, without any constraints. But this is part of a larger section of the city. It's part of the old city. Nearby the Western Wall, there is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Nearby is the El Mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
And the Dome of the
so Rock. We have to make a pattern that will allow all to practice the religion without limiting anyone. Yeah. And this is the pattern.
And I understand you are putting forward a vision. You believe in this. You've worked hard on it. But it is a very, very far away prospect now. And I wonder, therefore, if you could say something about how you persuade your own side. So what happens to Hamas, Mr. El-Kidwa, under this?
What happened to Hamas is what will be decided on the field in Gaza, basically. Of course, Hamas exists also in other places, but basically Gaza is
very... Does that mean you want Hamas to be destroyed, as the current Israeli government wants?
No, listen, destroying and eliminating and annihilating, these terms are not functional. I don't think that this is possible. What is going to happen is that Hamas will be weakened dramatically, and that we can see now. And of course, part of our vision, as well as what we are talking with other parties about, is precisely to form a Palestinian governmental structure void from any participation of Hamas, and I would add to that any other political factions. So that will be debated, that will be negotiated, that will be discussed among Palestinian factions, but at the end of the day, we will have structures that that are void from the direct participation of Hamas, and that was going to be a first step. We need, of course, to discuss the internal security, we need to discuss the arms, we need to discuss things like that. I do believe that this is possible and it's achievable, and that will be the first step in the right direction towards ending the war in Gaza, and after that, start the process of the overall political solution. Listen, the important thing here is to follow a comprehensive approach. I mean, fragmenting issues and trying to deal with small pieces, small fragments here and there is not going to do the trick. Mm-hmm. And actually, it is a way to spoil the game and to prevent the actual agreement in terms of the overall solution.
Events appear to be moving very fast, though, in the north of Gaza, in particular in recent weeks with the offensive that's underway. Ehud Olmert, do you think that what is happening in northern Gaza is a version of what has been called the general's plan, the ambition of emptying Gaza, parts of Gaza,
I hope
Palestinians?
Not. I hope not. Look, I think that at this point, I thought it a month ago, but certainly now, we have reached a point where there is no use and no benefit from continuing the military operation. We have destroyed Hamas for all practical purposes. Hamas will not be anymore in any dominant position in Gaza, which is what we wanted, because we need Gaza not to be the site for attacks against Israeli civilians as it was until the 7th of October and largely on the 7th of October. So we have achieved it. Now we have to reach an agreement that will bring back the hostages to pull out from Gaza completely. And Israel should not be interested. I make it a very important point, should not be interested in forcing people that live in Gaza away from where they live. Gaza has to be rebuilt, resurrected, with all the efforts that the international community can contribute to this. This should be our aim. We are not for killing people. We are for defending ourselves from terrorists.
Ehud Olmert, Nasser al-Kidwa, thank you very much.
Let's get the latest on the weather from Matt Taylor.
Thank you very much, Emma. Good morning, all. Pretty grey Monday out there. For England and Wales, quite blustery as well to go with the extensive cloud. Be prepared, there's going to be some outbreaks of rain drizzle just about anywhere through this morning. Some heavier bursts in the short term, though, now moving in across much of Devon, far southeast of Wales, East Yorkshire and also Lincolnshire. But into the afternoon, the rain and drizzle should be lighter and patchier. We'll be mainly confined to hills and coasts in the west, and there's a greater chance of one or two cloud breaks. Parts of northeast England, Cheshire, Northwest Midlands, also Kent and Suffolk, as well as parts of Sussex should get a few sunnier spells, but not a huge amount around. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, again, fairly cloudy here, but the patchy rain or drizzles are a good deal lighter. More of you starting the day dry and more of you staying dry throughout the day. The afternoon should look a little bit brighter in places, but the best of the sunshine will be confined really to Orkney and Shetland throughout. Any brighter breaks elsewhere will be a bit of a bonus. Temperatures today in Northern Scotland are 9 to 12 degrees. Rest of the UK, a very mild 14 to 17. Mild night to come tonight with lows of 9 to 13 Celsius. Further drizzle at times, but tomorrow a bit drier and a little bit brighter for many. That's how it's looking.
Matt, thanks very much for that. You're listening to Today. Keep it here with us on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussein and Emma Barnett.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 28th of October. The headlines this morning: Sir Keir Starmer will warn today that this week's budget must embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality. Labour has suspended the MP Mike Amesbury after video footage appeared to show him punching a man in the street. New talks about a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza are due to take place in Qatar.
And also coming up in the next hour, the master of the celebrity interview, Michael Parkinson, as you've never heard him before.
This is Michael Parkinson, or at least a version of me in this rather curious AI form. Now, I'll be honest with you, I haven't the foggiest idea how any of this technology actually works, but I think this new podcast might just surprise a few people when it's released.
I think it will. I'll be talking to his son. It's half term, though, to tell you about another part of the programme. Our Today programme, Book Club, is back with a spooky Halloween twist. Writers Frank Cottrell Boyce and Cressida Cowell will join us before 8:30. All that and more to come. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
Sir Keir Starmer will prepare the ground for the budget with a speech this morning in which he'll say that Britain must embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality. The Chancellor's statement on Wednesday is expected to be one of the most significant in recent history, with tax rises and spending cuts worth tens of billions of pounds. The Conservatives have accused Sir Keir of running a government of broken promises. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
The Prime Minister will say it's time we ignored the populist chorus of easy answers and were realistic about where we are as a country. In a speech in the West Midlands, Sir Keir Starmer will attempt to frame what he admits will be a difficult budget in the context of what he calls the harsh light of fiscal reality. He will argue the country faces the unprecedented challenge of weak public finances alongside crumbling public services. And he'll promise to run towards what he calls the tough decisions. The Chancellor is expected to increase taxes by billions of pounds, as well as change the rules around debt to allow more borrowing for longer-term infrastructure projects. But senior Labour MPs have told me of their concern about the gloomy warnings ahead of the budget, as well as fears councils and prisons are among areas that could miss out on extra funding. In an attempt to address those worries, the Prime Minister will claim better days are ahead, as he pledges to make Britain better off.
Paul Johnson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies told us he'd been frustrated during the election campaign earlier this year when both Labour and the Conservatives had dismissed his warnings about difficult choices ahead.
Everybody knew that there was a big problem with the public finances and we'd either have to get tax increases or significant spending cuts. And lo and behold, we're being told that, you know, that has now been discovered and it looks like we're going to get something like 40 billion of tax increases, if the briefing is to be believed, and that would make this one of the biggest tax-raising budgets ever.
The Office for Budget Responsibility has defended its decision to publish on the same day as the budget a report on what the government says is a black hole in the public finances inherited from the last Conservative administration. The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has written to the OBR expressing significant concern about the timing. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
In his letter to the OBR, Jeremy Hunt said its decision to publish its review at the same time as the budget would be seen as a political intervention. He's concerned that the timing is designed to make the case that tax rises are the result of a black hole in the last government's spending forecasts, which the OBR was not told about at the time. Last night, the OBR said the review was about its institutional relationship with the Treasury, not the conduct or decisions of ministers. During his time in office, Mr. Hunt was a notable supporter of the OBR, saying the Truss administration's decision to sideline the forecaster was the biggest reason for the crisis caused by the mini-budget 2 years ago. The current Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, told the BBC last week that what she called the £22 billion black hole was one of the reasons tax rises were needed, and the OBR would be publishing its review on how that was allowed to happen.
The MP Mike Amesbury has been suspended from the Labour Party after video footage emerged appearing to show him punching a man. Cheshire Police said a 55-year-old man had been interviewed voluntarily under caution following the incident in Frodsham in the early hours of Saturday. Mr. Amesbury has said he felt threatened. Graham Satchell reports.
This new video appears to show Mike Amesbury punching a man in the street. Two men are shown exchanging words. Then the Labour MP hits the man in the jaw and knocks him to the ground. The footage acquired by the Daily Mail then shows Mr. Amesbury apparently punching the man a further five times while he's on the floor before members of the public intervene. Mr. Amesbury has now been voluntarily interviewed under caution by Cheshire Police and released pending further inquiries. In a statement, Labour said Mike Amesbury's membership of the party had been suspended pending an investigation. It means he can't attend party meetings or take part in internal votes while the inquiry is ongoing. He's also lost the whip, so will not sit as a Labour MP during this period. The MP for Runcorn and Helsby hasn't responded to requests for comment. On social media, he said he'd felt threatened before the incident, had reported it to the police himself, and would cooperate with their inquiries.
Negotiations about a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of hostages being held there by Hamas are due to take place in Qatar. The Qatari Prime Minister is expected to meet Israeli and US intelligence chiefs. Egypt, which mediates between Israel and Hamas, has proposed an initial two-day pause in fighting and the release of four hostages. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Talks seeking a comprehensive, phased ceasefire in Gaza have repeatedly stalled, but many see Israel's killing of the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar earlier this month as having created a new opportunity to make progress on a deal. Israel says that meetings in Doha will look at the various possibilities to restart negotiations for the release of dozens of hostages still held by Hamas. While Hamas is not taking part, many of its leaders are based in Qatar. In an effort to break the deadlock in talks, Egypt has proposed a two-day truce during which four hostages would be freed. The plan also includes the release of some Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, the delivery of desperately needed humanitarian aid to Gaza, and 10 days of negotiations on a permanent ceasefire.
A prolific people smuggler has told BBC News about the forgery and fraud used to help migrants from Vietnam to reach Europe and the UK. This year, more Vietnamese people have crossed the channel in small boats than any other nationality. The man, who now lives in the UK, spoke to our correspondent Andrew Harding.
The man spoke to us on condition that we keep his identity confidential. He provided details to us about his work forging fake documents, things like bank statements and payslips, for Vietnamese people applying for visas to get to Europe. Once in the EU, many of them head to the French coast, where Vietnamese gangs arrange for crossings by small boats to the UK.
It's a very lucrative business. If you have a good reputation, the clients come to you. No force, no violence.
How do you justify what you do here? You've come to the UK illegally. You're still breaking the law by assisting other people to come here illegally.
I just do paperwork. I help people to travel. I don't force them to take certain routes.
The man denied trafficking people to the UK to work for criminal gangs. As part of our investigation, we contacted a different Vietnamese people smuggler in northern France who offered our undercover reporter a place on a small boat for £2,600. The smuggler promised a safe trip, despite the fact that more than 50 people have already drowned in the Channel this year.
Police Scotland says the number of rape allegations reported to officers has risen by almost 20% in a year. The force is launching the latest phase of a campaign to try to prevent sexual offending, which encourages young men to intervene when they see a friend behaving inappropriately towards women. Our Scotland correspondent, Katriana Renton, reports.
Overall, the number of sexual crimes reported to police in Scotland between April and September was up 3.2% on the same period last year, although some were alleged to have happened more than a year ago. Of the nearly 7,600 reports, 1,400 were alleged rapes, a 19.5% increase. Assistant Chief Constable Steve Johnson said he hoped that increased reporting of sexual crimes meant victims had more confidence to come forward. When asked about the figures, he said he believed the number probably represented the tip of the iceberg.
The French film star Gérard Depardieu has asked for his trial on charges of sexual assault to be delayed. The 75-year-old had been due in court today. His lawyer said he had made the request for health reasons. Gérard Depardieu is accused of sexually assaulting two women while they were shooting a film in 2021. He denies the charges. And a cheesemaker whose cheddar was among 22 tons of cheese stolen by scammers in London last week has condemned the theft as a violation. £300,000 worth of cheese was taken from the specialist retailer Neal's Yard Dairy by fraudsters posing as a wholesaler for a French supermarket. The chef, Jamie Oliver, has urged people to be on the lookout for lorry loads of posh cheese. Patrick Holden from the Holden Park Dairy, whose Welsh Havod cheddar was taken, told us the haul may have been sold in Russia or the Middle East.
We were particularly happy that we had an order from France, and we were quite excited. So it came as a tremendous shock when we found that actually this was theft. And it was a violation, really, because we rely on trust and transparency right the way through to the people who eat our cheese. So this really was a bit of a violation.
Patrick Holden from the Holden Park Dairy.
Thanks very much, Charles. It's 8:10. It's nearly here. The budget. Finally, what the new government plans to do to plug the black hole in the public finances will officially be announced on Wednesday by this country's first female chancellor. Much has been trailed, including the expectation that Rachel Reeves will increase employers' national insurance contributions in what could be one of the biggest tax-raising budgets overall in history. This is because the majority of the money raised is expected to be through tax rises, which could amount to as much as £35 billion, and a much smaller portion will come through spending cuts. Remember, though, this is a party which stood on a manifesto that working people would pay no higher taxes. So who will pay? Non-working people? The Conservatives have accused Keir Starmer of running a government of broken promises and stoking a class war. The Prime Minister, in a speech today, will try to ready the ground for the budget by saying Britain must embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality. But will this government's plan work? This preparation by Sir Keir Starmer comes at the same time the Labour Party has had to suspend one of its MPs, Mike Amesbury, after extraordinary footage emerged of him appearing to punch a man in the face and then, when he hit the floor, keep punching him five more times
as he lay on the ground, something we'll come on to shortly. But I'm joined now by Pat McFadden, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster and Labour's campaign coordinator during the general election, as you may recall. We spoke rather a few times then. Good morning. As I say, we will come to that shocking footage in short order on the front page of some of the newspapers this morning. But in Sir Keir Starmer's speech today, he says it's time to embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality, I quote, so we can come together behind a credible long-term plan. Do you think you've alienated some of the people who will be picking up that tax bill?
Well, I hope not. And what Sir Keir Starmer is saying today in his speech is he is framing the background for the budget that's going to come in a couple of days' time. And I think when people look at the budget, they should look to it to do three things. The first is to stabilise the public finances. They're not stable at the moment. They weren't stable when we came into office. And that's a difficult job, but it's important that we do that. The second is to try to start to change the picture in public services and the NHS in particular. People expect that from a Labour government, and we want to do that with a combination of both investment and reform. And the third thing, and this is really important, is to change the country's investment story for the future, because the plans that we inherited were for a decline in investment, which would just mean that we didn't build the houses we need, the transport infrastructure we need, we wouldn't have the green infrastructure that we need, and we weren't prepared to accept that story. So people should look to the budget to do those three things when the Chancellor gets to her feet on Wednesday.
You say you hope you haven't alienated people, because to your point about public service there and the need for tax rises, something that even I remember talking to you about and my colleagues here, you repeatedly said when campaigning in that role for the general election campaign for Labour wasn't going to affect working people. You talk about hoping not to have alienated people, but what are people called who are going to have to pay more if they are not working people but they have a job?
We will keep to the tax promises that we made during the election. They were in our manifesto, they applied during the campaign, and they'll also apply when the Chancellor gets to her feet. And that is the most important thing.
That's not what I asked, though. I'll get to that in a moment, because there's something to put to you very specific on that. What are people called who are not working people who are going to be picking up this higher tax bill?
When we talked about working people, we referred to the promises that we made in the manifesto around the taxes on wages that people pay. They won't go up when the Chancellor gets to her feet on Wednesday, and that's what we meant.
I just want to know what they're called, Pat.
And we also use this phrase in a different way, which is important and hasn't been covered so much in this discussion about wage levels and job descriptions. And that was changing the job description of the Labour Party itself away from being focused more on internal interests and on stakeholder management and actually working for the British public again.
Exactly, they're the British people. And
exactly.
Can you understand why you have alienated and annoyed some people? Can you understand yesterday when people are watching the television or seeing a clip of my colleague Laura Koonsberg interviewing the Education Secretary, who refused to say whether a business owner who earns 13,000 net profit, a small business owner, that's the average amount, whether they are a working person or not?
Because I don't think it's about a definition of wages. It's about keeping your promises. And we will keep our promises when the budget takes place on Wednesday. And this point about the British public is really important, because we changed the Labour Party to put it back in the service of the British public. And that's what people will see in this budget when it comes on Wednesday.
You're not being honest now. You can't answer the question. What are people called who are making money but and going to pay more tax if they are not working people? Can you name them?
I think you're going to get the most honest budget on Wednesday that you've had in many years. We're going to end the fiscal fiction of things being announced which had no money set aside for them.
Why can't
things,
you answer the question?
Things like...
Why are you answering... I have to say, you're answering about what's going to be in the budget. And that, you know, we've been told repeatedly, let's not speculate, let's wait for the budget. So I'm asking you something completely different. I could read to you what landlords said after they heard what Sir Keir Starmer had to say the other day. They talked about the fact that he was stoking misconceptions about them. It's simply not true that landlords are not working people. When the Prime Minister said he didn't recognise them as much, Ben Beadle, the chief executive of the National Residential Landlords Association, said rather than stoking misconceptions, the government needs to focus instead on the key challenge in the rental market. Landlords are working people. I'm asking you, what are people like landlords if they are not working people? What are they called to you in the Labour government?
Well, some will be working, some will be, they wouldn't fit that description. But I honestly think this thing about income levels and job descriptions is not the right way to look at this. The right way to look at this is, will we stick to the manifesto promises that we made on tax? And we will. And you'll see that when the Chancellor gets to her feet.
Well, why is Mervyn King, Wednesday? The former Bank of England governor, said this debate about putting up taxes on working people and saying that you're not, through, for instance, going with national insurance raises on employers, was a terrible illusion. He says taxes are to be paid by people. You've broken your manifesto pledge, haven't you?
No, we haven't. And it's important that we don't let that stand and let that fly. And you can pick your Bank of England voices. I saw Andy Haldane, who was the chief economist of the Bank of England, also interviewed yesterday, saying that what we were doing by taking into account assets when it comes to future investment was precisely the right thing to do.
You can pick the question that you choose to listen to the answer to as well, with all due respect.
Well, you picked a Bank of England voice to quote to me. I'm quoting a Bank of England voice.
Yeah, but to a different question. And that is really crucial to our listeners who perhaps don't spend their Sundays catching up like you and I on what political or Bank of England, former Bank of England employees say. They want to know why you said there wouldn't be higher taxes. They want to know who these working people are who are not defined as working people. And I say to you, are working people who are picking up the extra tax bill not working people? You can't answer that. So I'll put something else to you. Rachel Reeves wrote a column in The Sun on Sunday yesterday talking about this is a budget for strivers. Are those people who are not deemed working people like landlords by this government, are they not strivers?
Look, when we make these decisions, we are not talking about picking out one set of people or another. We're trying to do this in a fair way. We made promises in the manifesto about income taxes, about national insurance and VAT. We will keep to those promises when the Chancellor gets to her feet on Wednesday. It's important that we do that so that we stabilise the public finances, we start to turn around investment in the NHS to improve it, and we change the country's investment story for the future, and we do it in a fair way.
Do you accept you have annoyed some people who are going to pay more by not describing them as working people? Can you say yes or no? Do you accept that?
I think if people are annoyed, what they should be annoyed at is the fiscal fiction, the fictions that we inherited that have forced us to face up to this situation. And you have the spectacle today.
If you've annoyed people, then telling them what they should be annoyed about is not really the right way to go. Because I put to you that don't you want people to want to invest in public services? Don't you want to take them with you? And the way you've managed this, by effectively, some would say, wordplay around how taxes are not going up on your payslip, but effectively, if you take one example, extending the freeze on tax bans is a tax rise. The way that you're not being fully honest about that, and the way that your education secretary yesterday couldn't say a small business owner was a working person, has alienated and annoyed a lot of people you're going to expect more money from.
Well, I do think people want us to invest in the public services. They expect that from a Labour government, particularly with the NHS. We want to do that. We did it the last time we were in government. We left office in 2010 with the highest rates of public satisfaction with the NHS on record. We came back into office in 2024 with the lowest levels of public satisfaction in the NHS. So people do want to see that investment. That is something that will start on Wednesday.
But to those people that you've annoyed,
this can't happen overnight.
Yes, of course it can't happen overnight, and we will hear the plan. But to those people you have annoyed, what do you say to them?
Look, I say we've got a difficult job in trying to sort out the public finances, which we inherited in a very bad way from the Conservatives. That's why they've chosen today to attack the OBR. They're running scared of an independent verdict on the situation that we inherited. No government gets to choose
the circumstances in which it comes to office. They want to hear if they're working people, if they're strivers. They want to be motivated by leadership, and they don't want to feel necessarily penalised or isolated or annoyed. And that's what you have to say to them. Fiscal fiction, go with the party line on that.
Well, I think they will see leadership on Wednesday because we'll do those three things that I said.
OK, I have to, just for the limited time we have left, this video of Mike Amesbury, your MP, in Run Corners was nearly 3 a.m. in the morning. This footage over the weekend appears to show him hitting a man in the jaw and then punching him a further five times while he's on the floor. He's been voluntarily, the MP as was, interviewed by the police, I should say Labour MP as was, and released pending further inquiry. Mike Amesbury said he felt threatened. He's been suspended from the Labour Party. Have you seen this extraordinary footage?
Yes, I have.
And what do you make of it?
Well, look, it's very graphic, and he's been suspended from the Labour Party. That applies to both his membership and to his position as a Labour MP while this police investigation goes on. I think it's important the police do their work, reach a conclusion to their investigation, and it's probably not wise for me to say much more than that right now.
I wouldn't expect you to comment on that, Mr McFadden, but the former Conservative MP, Dehenna Davison, whose father died from a single punch, has called the CCTV footage horrendous. She's also talked about the police investigating. But such violence, whatever background to the altercation, because he does appear to keep punching the man on the floor, can never be justified. Do you think there is any road back from what you have seen in that footage for him to be an MP again?
I want to let the police do their job and reach a conclusion before I say anything more about this.
That's not necessarily a matter of criminality. That's your view in your role around that cabinet table.
Yeah, my view is the police need to do their job now and reach their conclusion. And I think that's the wise thing for me to say right now.
Pat McFadden, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 23 minutes past eight. If you have children on half term this week, they'll probably be thinking about Halloween. Actually, that's probably the case for those who aren't off school this week too. But we thought Halloween week presented an opportunity to revive our children's book club with some suitably themed recommendations. So it is hello once again to writers Frank Cottrell Boyce, who's also Waterston's Children's Laureate at the moment, and Cressida Cowell, who's a former Children's Laureate and who's well known for the How to Train Your Dragon series. Good morning, Frank and Cressida. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Cressida, why don't you go first with your Halloween or suitably scary or spooky themed recommendations?
My first recommendation for picture books is Colin's Castle by Holly Swain, which is a picture book about a vampire who's moving in and his castle is haunted by a duck. And I think this would be such fun to read with a little kid who's just going to love the role reversal there, because that's what I think Halloween, a lot of stories about Halloween are all about role reversal, kind of the vampire is the one who you should be rooting for there. Midnight Treasure is my recommendation by Piers Tordé for middle grade. This is a new book. It's wonderful, about a werewolf and a young werewolf who's about to come into their werewolf powers, and their companion, who's a vampire who's been turned into a dog, and it's a treasure hunt. It's just, it's beautifully written. It's marvellous. And my recommendation for teens, which all my teens love, was Skullduggery Pleasant by Derek Landy. Magnificent female strong protagonist called Valkyrie, and a skeleton, she's a detective, and her skeleton sidekick. The wisecracking is great. All my teens love that one.
Great names in that, Valkyrie and Skullduggery Pleasant. Frank, go on, beat that.
I'm going to start with one of the great classics, which is Funny Bones by Alan and Janet Ahlberg, which has got this great riff in it. That I think one of the great things about reading the ghost stories to children is that they get the chance to join in. So Funny Bones has got that in a dark, dark town, in a dark, dark house, in a dark, dark street, that you all join in. So that's a wonderful book. It's very warm, but it's brilliantly graphic. It's back pages and the white skeletons. I can't see anybody not loving that book. For middle grade, I've gone for a newer book, which is heavily illustrated, and I think it's a masterpiece. It's by John Classen. It's called The Skull. John Classen's famous for I Want My Hat Back and This Is Not My Hat. Very, very funny books. This is really dark. It's based on a Tyrolean folk tale. It's by a little girl called Attila, who comes to a dark castle, which is haunted by a skull. And the twist is that they discover that the skull is scared of something else. And Attila has to back him up. It's a really wonderful book. I've read it to some groups of supposedly quite difficult children, and been absolutely gripped by it. And even though I'm so story aware, I didn't know where this was going. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. And then for older readers, for YA, I've gone for a classic. I've gone for Elidor by Alan Garner, who is 90 this year. And Elidor is contains some of his best writing, which probably means it's some of the best writing ever. It's set in a very recognisable Manchester, and it's about another world pressing in on this group of children. It's not strictly a ghost story, it's possibly a fantasy story, but there were bits in it that absolutely terrified me and made me scared of walking around my own streets as a kid.
Well, they all sound absolutely brilliant, and we'll put them up on social media, all of your recommendations, in case anyone missed them while listening. I wonder, Cressida, if you have a reluctant reader, is when you've got something like Halloween coming up, and the same would be true for, you know, other occasions in the year, is it a good way to hook children into a book?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, these times, these holiday times, because parents and children's lives are so busy. So holiday times and half term are a great time to focus on getting kids reading for pleasure. So reading a book with a kid, even if they're older, or listening on an audio together, if you're listening together, you're sending, and the book, if the book makes the parent laugh or scares the parent or make the parent, like Frank was just saying, want to know what happens yet next, it sends a really important message to the kid that books are powerful things. You know, your parent is just as, you know, it makes your parent laugh, your dad laugh, as well as your mum, or and enjoying a book with your kid, and something like the Collins Castle, enjoying that with the kid, sitting down, and the kid, you know, spotting the duck, and you know, seeing where it's, you know, it's a really, it becomes a really joyful experience if you enjoy these books together.
And so I guess it's not just about the time, Frank, but also, you know, child thinking about trick or treating. Oh, you know, maybe that does lead you towards a book that is kind of on the same theme.
Yeah, when you get back home, I think there's something, it's a shared reading, isn't it? It's that thing of, like, let's all get together, put all the lights out and tell a story by torchlight. That, you know, when you have a shared reading, like, if you all laugh together or you all scream together, that's a really joyous thing. I think, you know, everybody, yeah, there's something about, this probably goes back to the Ice Age, doesn't it? There's something about the depth of winter, a little spark of fire and a terrifying story that is deep within us.
Thank you both very much. As ever, Frank Cottrell-Boyce and Cressida Cowell.
There you go. It's 29 minutes past eight. Lots to think about, but let's get the latest on the sport from Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Football headlines to start, and a 2-2 draw between Premier League title rivals Arsenal and Liverpool yesterday at Emirates Stadium means Manchester City start the week at the top of the table. West Ham had a 2-1 win over Manchester United to keep the pressure on the United manager Erik ten Hag, and Celtic are back at the top of the Scottish Premiership after a 3-0 win over Motherwell. Now, the British tennis number one, Jack Draper, has won the biggest title of his career at the ATP 500 level in Vienna, and will be the new world number 15 today. I spoke to the US Open semi-finalist after his win yesterday about how, after several injuries as well as anxiety issues on court, this feels like an important title win for his confidence.
I went through a lot of kind of ups and downs at the start of the season, lots of difficult matches that I didn't quite get through them. But I've been putting in some real consistent work for a while now with my team, and kept a really positive and good mindset of wanting to keep on improving. I'm feeling more and more comfortable and more confident in myself to play at this level and win matches. So I feel incredibly proud of myself and very, very pumped with the win here in Vienna.
You had to hold off two top 25 players in both the semi-finals and the final. And your mum told me, and your coach told me, that winning that title in Stuttgart in the summer really changed your belief. How do you think this, the biggest title that you've won, will change that even more, your belief levels?
The more experience, the more matches I'm having on this biggest stages against the great players in the sport right now, it's given me more confidence that I can do it on a regular basis. You know, sometimes in tennis, you believe in yourself as a player, you believe in the work that you're doing, but until you actually do it, you don't really have that belief that you can really do it consistently. And I suppose with good results and with confidence, you know, that goes such a long way.
You had that excellent run to the semi-finals at the US Open. We talked in New York about your conditioning and your anxiety levels, and you said you were going to be working on those things. It was an exhausting week in Vienna for you. Have you been able to start working on that, or is that something for the off-season?
I think with me, I'm always someone who works incredibly hard physically. I try and keep on improving all the time on that aspect of things. You know, this is my first full year on the tour, I suppose. I'm working a lot of things out about myself, and, you know, I'm far from the finished article. It's not just the tennis that needs improving. You know, the way I deal with situations needs to continually improve. And so I'm still young, I've still got time, and I'm still trying to figure out what makes me tick and what makes me stay calm on the court. You know, there's no doubt in that a lot of physicality is linked to mentality as well. The anxiety of being out there on the court, tennis is an extremely tough mental sport, so you kind of have to have the full package if you want to be great. And I'm going to keep on trying to learn about myself and improve.
And you have done that. You have improved. You've won the biggest title of your career so far. You are also now going to be at a career high ranking of world number 15. The tennis schedule is relentless. Are you able to take any time to celebrate, or at least take a moment to reflect on the last week?
Of course, I'll stay present. I'll enjoy the moment. There's many times where you might take a tough loss. You're thinking about those moments in the future where you're going to be on a high, and this is one of those moments. But at the same time, the nature of the tennis world is that I'm going to have to play my first round in Paris on Tuesday. So I've got about probably 36 hours to get used to the conditions there, to rest up, get my body in a good position. If I go on court on Tuesday and I'm not at 110%, then I'm at this level you lose. So I can reflect and I can be very proud of my achievements. But at the same time, I always want more, and I always want to keep on doing better and better.
Hedman, Rozenski, Murray, that's the list of British winners that have won the title in Vienna. Not a bad list to join, is it?
No, not bad at all. You know, those guys are legends of British tennis, and to be a part of that group winning here in Vienna, it's a tournament that the Brits like. So maybe I'll come back here many years to come and win more than they did here. So we'll see. But yeah, obviously amazing to be a part of that group.
Well, congratulations again, Jack Draper. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
And the British driver Lando Norris has described Max Verstappen as dangerous after the championship leader was given a penalty for forcing Norris off the track in Mexico City in an eventful race that was won by Ferrari's Carlos Sainz. It's getting rather spicy as we reach the end of the Formula One season.
Cathy, thank you very much. Now at 9 o'clock, we have Start the Week, and Tom Sutcliffe is here with the details. Morning, Tom.
Morning, Michelle. We're talking about tragic heroines this week. We've got two fictional women and one real one, all of them caught in a snare of power politics and gender prejudices. The playwright Zinni Harris is with us to talk about putting the Duchess of Malfi right at the centre of the play that bears her name. Stefan Stern explains what Lady Macbeth can teach us about not letting ambition ruin your life, essentially rein it in when things start getting stabby. And the historian Jade Scott on what newly decoded letters reveal about Mary, Queen of Scots' knowledge of the many plots to free her. At Start the Week, just after nine, women determined to decide their own fate by fair means and foul.
Sounds good. I look at the weather. Today will be largely cloudy across the UK with patchy rain for England and Wales, bright spells in the northeast.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett, Michelle Hussein and Charles Carroll with the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will warn that Britain must embrace the harsh light of fiscal reality when he gives a speech later today. He's expected to set the tone for the budget on Wednesday by saying that the country faces unprecedented economic challenges, but he'll say the better days lie ahead. The Labour Party has suspended the MP Mike Amesbury after footage emerged of him appearing to punch a man. Cheshire Police said a 55-year-old man had been interviewed voluntarily under caution following the incident in Frodsham in the early hours of Saturday morning. The Cabinet Office Minister, Pat McFadden, told us the video was very graphic and the police should be left to continue their investigation. And delegates from Israel, the US and Qatar are meeting in Doha to restart negotiations about a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of hostages being held there by Hamas. Egypt has proposed an initial two-day pause in fighting to allow the exchange of four hostages for Palestinian prisoners.
Charles, thank you very much. It is 25 to 9. We heard earlier about the BBC investigation revealing the backstory of the Vietnamese people who arrive in the UK on small boats. That group has been a very significant one in this year's numbers. It starts, a people smuggler told us, with forging documents to get visas to fly from Vietnam into countries on the European continent and move on from there. Here's part of what Andrew Harding found.
It's a very lucrative business. If you have a good reputation, the clients come to you. No force, no violence.
We'll call him Tan, a slim, neatly dressed man who crossed the channel in a small boat earlier this year. He spent most of his adult life in the smuggling business. We're keeping his identity confidential, the only way he'd agree to tell us about his work. He's now applying for asylum in the UK.
You told the British authorities you've been trafficked here, but that's not true, is it?
No, I was not trafficked here. I said I was, because that's just the way it's done. It's what you say in order to get asylum.
The police and human rights groups say that's nonsense, that many Vietnamese brought to the UK are victims of modern slavery. For some years, Tan worked for a smuggling gang in France, but he then went back to Vietnam, where he began forging documents for people trying to get visas to Europe.
I'm good at this work. People trust me. I never fail.
Well, we're joined now by Mimi Vu, who's an anti-trafficking and modern slavery expert based in Ho Chi Minh City. Earlier this year, she completed a report for the International Organization of Migration on the trafficking of people from Vietnam. Mimi Vu, what is it, would you say, that has led to this large increase in the numbers coming to the UK this year?
Well, I would say it's not anything to do with the actual numbers of Vietnamese leaving Vietnam right now, because it's never a direct route from Vietnam to the UK. The surge that you get earlier this year is actually a reflection of people who had come over in the last few weeks, few months, or even couple of years. We know, I know at least speaking to experts and reporters and NGO workers on the ground in northern France, that a lot of the migrants who were waiting to cross earlier this year were actually a lot of girls and a lot of minors, so people under 18 years old. And that means that most likely they came between 2021 and 2023 through the short-term student visa scheme going through Malta, which was shut down by the Maltese authorities in September of 2023. So overall and in general, the migration of Vietnamese to Europe and the UK via labor visas has been a consistent and constant movement for the last three or four decades, since after the 1975, end of the war between Vietnam and the US in 1975.
But of course, Vietnam has economically done so much better since then, since the beginning of the period you're talking about.
Yes. But you have to, this is where culture, you have to have a very good understanding of Vietnamese culture and history and geopolitics as well to understand why this continues. Most of the Vietnamese migrants and consequently victims of modern slavery and trafficking only come from a handful of provinces in Vietnam. Provinces like Nghệ An, Hà Tĩnh, Quảng Bình, Hải Phòng, and Quảng Ninh. These are all historically the provinces that have sent Vietnamese workers in the 1980s to the former Soviet bloc countries that are now part of Eastern and Central Europe. That formed part of the traditional migration route that led from Vietnam through Europe and into the UK, and that exists to this day. It created the labor service or labor recruitment services that exist to this day. It created, in large part, the remittance culture that exists to this day, especially into those particular provinces that I mentioned. And Vietnam overall is still a remittance country. We're top 10 in the world.
So essentially it's part of life in those parts of Vietnam to go abroad to work and to send money home in remittances.
Exactly. And it is a legitimate way of earning money to support your family. Vietnam is a labor export country.
Okay.
The problem is that the roots and the gatekeepers going into Europe and the UK, for example, are, you know, a lot of them are unethical and many are associated with transnational human smuggling and organized crime networks.
But is a key way to crack down on this trade then, on those very, very difficult aspects of it, to tighten up the visas into European countries? You mentioned Malta earlier, but a lot of them, are they coming in on visas to Eastern European and Central European countries?
Almost all of them, because what's happening at the same time, so we're talking about market forces here, right? Because in essence, trafficking in modern slavery is a business. So we have to look at it as a business, and it operates on supply and demand. So there are many things happening at the same time. One is the huge increase in demand for labor in Central and Eastern European countries, such as Hungary, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and also Germany. All those countries are suffering from extreme labor shortages, and they have to import between, 200 to 400,000 workers per year. And because Vietnam has a history, or Vietnamese workers have a history in those countries as being very diligent, good workers, the recruiters in the companies in those countries like to recruit from Vietnam. However, you have Vietnamese migrants who truly, genuinely want to work in these countries. They want to work. They are going overseas temporarily. They don't plan on living in Europe forever. But what happens is the crackdown should be happening and the tightening should be happening on the recruitment agencies that are tricking the Vietnamese into overpaying and borrowing money from loan sharks or black market money lenders that entrap them in the debt bondage. That is what is then used to control them and enslave them once they get into Europe and the UK.
Thanks so much for explaining all of that. Mimi Vu, thank you.
It's 19 minutes to nine. Ahead of expected capital gains tax rises in Wednesday's much-trailed budget, Dale Vince, one of Labour's top donors, the green energy tycoon, has said rich people threatening to leave Britain should F off. He rejects the idea that any changes will hurt entrepreneurialism. I can talk now to Charlie Mullins, the millionaire founder of Pimlico Plumbers and a former Conservative donor, one of those rich people who is planning to leave the UK, and Julia Davis, an investor and founding member of Patriotic Millionaires. Good morning to you both. Charlie, if I can start with you, good morning. Why are you planning to leave and split your time, as I understand it, between Spain and Dubai?
Well, I've already left, is the answer. I left once Labour got into government. I've left because many reasons, because of the tax situation, where he's going to obviously increase the rate of tax for workers. He's going to increase inheritance tax, capital gains. He's going to be hammering pensions. He's already taking money from the pensioners. And of course, workers' rights. So I think Labour are very anti-business. And I believe they're just going to destroy the UK more than what it is. And
do you not feel...
As you're probably aware...
I was just going to say, because there's a long list there, and I'll bring Julia in a moment, but do you not feel any compulsion to try and pay more into that system when we talk about fiscal reality and supporting the NHS? Do you not feel any compulsion on that front?
Yes, of course I do. I mean, I've paid into the system for 55 years. It's quite a big decision to leave. I've paid in over 100 million. Into the system. I've employed many people. I've trained many people. Of course, it's a big move, but I'm at the stage where I'm not prepared to put any more money into the pot that they're just going to, what I call, waste it on people that are not contributing.
Julia, let's bring in Julia then. Slightly at the end of that point there, but you got the other points as well that Charlie was saying. Do you understand any of what he has to say of why he's already left?
I understand what he's saying. I don't agree with it. My money comes from helping to set up a company. So I've been an entrepreneur and I now invest in entrepreneurs. And I've spoken to many of my founders now, and I can speak from my own experience. And I can tell you that when people are setting up a business, they do it for many reasons. And they're not thinking about what kind of capital gains tax or other taxes they'll pay if they're successful and they make some money, from selling their business later on. What they need is well-funded services and infrastructure so that their staff can get the healthcare that they need, so that the family members of their staff can get the healthcare that they need. So I'm speaking to you now from hospital. My mum was taken into hospital urgently just over a week ago. Very fortunately, the ambulance turned up quickly, because if not, she wouldn't be with us now. But the staff here are wonderful. We talk a lot about entrepreneurs working very hard. Yes, they do, but they don't work as hard as the people that have been looking after my mum since she's been in here. It's just incredible. We have to fund that. So if people like Charlie aren't willing to do that, then we have to get that money from somewhere, because no one's saying we don't need the money to support our services. So then that has to come from working people. And that's coming out of what working people are struggling to already stretch over their bills, their housing, their food. Whereas if it comes from wealthy people like myself and Charlie, What's it coming out
well,
of?
Some you know, of what, without what do they need Julia, that Julia, money with, for? Without retreading what we've just discussed, and people can go back and listen yes. to it in full with the cabinet minister, with Pat McFadden there. There's been some concern about the fact that people had felt that there were going to be no tax rises to working people, only to find that they're no longer included in the working people definition. But Charlie, what would you say to Julia and are going to experience higher bills when they've perhaps not scheduled or planned for that? Charlie, what do you say back to Julia?
Yeah, well, let me just say, sorry to hear about your mother, and hopefully things turn out all right. And yes, we do have a great NHS system, and if we had more money, it'd be even much better than what it is. But as Julie says, that if they don't get it off the entrepreneurs, the business people, the investors, the people that are wealth creators, then yes, it will fall onto the average working person because they need to raise money. But, you know, by driving out the entrepreneur or the businessman or somebody that sort of, you know, creates work kind of thing and employs people, we're going to be worse off. And I think that's the point we're making, Julie. We're not saying it's right. We're saying is that you get to a situation is you can't keep paying into the system more and more and more. You're going to be, what's the point of opening a business? I mean, as you know, Julie, I think many businesses are closing down and many more will close down when the budget is out and many more people will leave the UK. I think we should be incentivising people to stay. Not penalising.
Well,
them.
Some of what the Labour government, Charlie, are saying is around incentivising. They just had a huge gathering of business leaders. Perhaps they would say that. But Julia, what would you say back to Charlie?
Yeah, so let's be very clear. Nobody is driving wealthy people out of the UK. They are choosing to leave the UK instead of contributing to fund our public services and infrastructure, which desperately need it. And not just people like my mum desperately need that infrastructure and public services. Businesses need that too. So we absolutely need to invest in transitioning to the future-facing businesses that are going to address the energy transition. They're going to address, you know, like moving us to a circular economy. They need targeted investment. So taxing working people at higher rates than capital gains, that is a very inefficient way of supporting entrepreneurship and businesses. We need targeted support for the businesses we absolutely need. I would say to those people who are saying that I don't want to pay more in tax, even though I can afford to, I don't want to pay a little bit more in tax. I would rather struggling working people pay that extra money. Think about what you're going to pay that money. What are you going to use that money for that you're not prepared to invest in our NHS, in our schools, in transitioning to, you know, the businesses of the future?
It's going to be
less important than putting food on the table and paying the bills, which is what working people are doing with the money that they have.
Different views there from Julia Davis, an investor and founding member of Patriotic Millionaires, and Charlie Mullins, who's already left the UK, the millionaire founder of Pimlico Plumbers, and made his case too.
Quick mention of Woman's Hour this morning, because Nuala's guest is going to be Anna Maxwell-Martin. Her very recent role, or one of her most recent roles, is on the iPlayer currently in BBC One's Ludwig. But she's going to be talking this morning about her new true crime drama, which is called Until I Kill You. So that's on Woman's Hour this morning from 10 o'clock.
Looking forward. I'm now a listener, as opposed to the presenter of it. But talking about presenting and talking about being a journalist, I loved the late Michael Parkinson's interviews, especially as a young wannabe journalist. But the news that he's back on a podcast with some new interviews, courtesy of some AI magic. What does it mean? How should we feel? Have a listen to this.
Good morning to listeners of the Today programme and actually all the listeners of BBC Radio 4. This is Michael Parkinson, or at least a version of me in this rather curious AI form. Now, I'll be honest with you, I haven't the foggiest idea how any of this technology actually works, but I must say I'm excited by it all. I know some of you might find the idea of an AI me a bit odd, but the team at Deep Fusion and my son Mike know what they're doing. I think this new podcast might just surprise a few people when it's released, but don't let that stop you from giving Jamie and Mike a good grilling. They can handle it. Anyway, thank you for taking an interest, and I hope you'll enjoy what's to come.
Well, they're here, Mike Parkinson, Michael Parkinson's son, who's backing the podcast. It's great when you could write the script for the journalist, I find, saying how wonderful you are, but give a good grilling. And Jamie Anderson from Deep Fusion Film, one of the creators of the podcast. Mike, you know, your father died last year. Yeah. A lot of people very fond of him, of course. How is that for you, hearing that?
I have always, because I worked with my father for 20-odd years, I've always had a very easy way of separating the man that put on the suit and walked down the stairs, which I referred to as Michael, and my father who walked down the stairs in his dressing gown, which is a very different man. He was my father. The only time sometimes when it actually draws me up is when he uses my name. which is, it's strange. It has a sort of slight, something fires off in the brain. But other than that, it is, I think, extraordinary what they've achieved, because I didn't really think it was going to be as accurate as that. And what also, I had a very brief conversation with Jamie outside, and he mentioned something, because they are trying, they're just working with it. And apparently the great thing about this AI is it listens. It really listens, which is extraordinary, given the fact that's exactly what my father's motif was.
Do you think your dad would like this?
I think my dad would have been fascinated by it. My father was, in many ways, a complete technophobe. He couldn't turn on a mobile phone.
But just the idea of bringing it back and doing, you know, new interviews.
Yes, because we had a long history of conversations when we were working together about the idea of how would he ever have got to interview people that he never did. So we had this sort of jokey idea about having some kind of thing called Jurassic Talk Show, where he would have a collection of people that brought back to life, and he would go down and interview them. And his great lineup was Don Bradman, Frank Sinatra, and also Rita Hayworth. And so
that's a running order.
Now it is. Now it snowballed on from there. We wanted to go and do a podcast, and before he died, we talked about doing a podcast, and unfortunately, he passed away before it came true. Which is where Deep Fusion came in, because I came to them and said, well, if we wanted to do this podcast with my father literally talking about his archive, is it possible? And they said, oh, it's more than possible, and we think we can do something.
So just to say, I'll bring you in now, Jamie, from Deep Fusion. What are you going to hear on this? It's him around his interviews or new interviews?
It's a brand new interviews, and the AI that we've created is as close to the late Sir Michael as we could possibly get it.
Yes, I should have said Sir Michael.
Yes, I should. All that reverence.
My apologies.
He is autonomous, so we let him start the interview, and after that, it is up to AI Sir Michael, who is trained on Sir Michael's style and his interview questions and the formats that he's done over the decades.
Who are the guests? Can we know?
We can't tell you any guests yet. We have a few slots remaining, but they are notable, noteworthy people.
But they're real people alive rather than the wish list we were just talking about.
No. So it's a reversal of that.
And is AI good enough to do Michelle and I our job this morning? We were wondering if we could put it in.
I don't think it's about being better. This is, you know, the AI Michael is not replacing a presenter. It is a new podcast where Sir Michael's legacy is continued. So it's not taking away a presenter's job. I mean, if you wanted to have a morning off, absolutely, it could do that for you.
Well, yeah, always with a bit more sleep, Michelle, right? But the thing I was going to say, though, is do you worry in any way, and whoever would like to answer this might perhaps, about this being taken as real by people? So maybe they don't know your father passed away last year. You know, not everybody's always up to date, and then they hear something and they think, this is journalism.
No, because one of the things I absolutely made clear to Jamie and Ben when I went out there is I really want this to be absolutely 100%. This is an AI iteration. And Jamie and Ben are 100% very ethical in their approach towards it. They are very aware of the legal issues, very aware of the ethical issues, and they will not in any way, shape or form try to pass this off as real. And what's interesting from my perspective is like going back to 1971 with my father now, because when he came in 1971, he was a new person on the block, trying to launch a new format, trying to launch a new approach to interviewing, trying to find an audience. That's kind of what we're doing in 2024 with a new iteration. We have to go and find a new audience, a younger audience, one that possibly wasn't aware of my father could do. And that's what this technology can do. And I think in many ways, it's a wonderful way of extending the life of someone who was an outlier and a unique talent of his generation.
Well, some will feel very strongly about it in the way you're talking about, but perhaps also in the opposite way. We've seen it a little bit with the ABBA experience, of course, where people, you know, are thinking about how that makes them feel as well. But Mike Parkinson, Jamie Anderson, good to talk to you in the flesh.
Thank you.
I'd love to ask, does the AI Parkinson ever ask a duff question, one that makes it obvious it's not
He never asked a duff question in life. How dare you?
Well, obviously, that's why I wonder if there's ever a question that makes you have to clip it out
He's still being worked on. We're still modifying him all the time. And he does occasionally get stuck on a certain area, so he can receive some direction.
Yes.
But mostly it's up to him, and he's doing a great job.
He's a lot easier to produce.
are you asking for a friend, Michelle?
Yeah, we're storing all of this up for
we need all the help we can get.
But also keeping it at bay, kind of both. Right.
Let us move on. It is 5 to 9. Is the school run a good time for serious discussions or what might even be called teachable moments? Prince William thinks so because he's revealed in an ITV documentary going out this week that he's talked about homelessness with his three children while taking them to school, sparked by them seeing people sleeping rough and asking him about it. Helen Thorne is here in the studio, one of the mummies from the Scummy Mummies podcast. And Julia Samuel is on the line, psychotherapist and author. Morning to you both. Morning. Julia, school run, good or bad moment?
I think it's, cars are good because you're not eyeballing each other, so it helps children feel less self-conscious and more open. I think the school run for general conversations, not for kind of sensitive family difficult conversations, because it's, you know, getting them into school and you don't want them to be distressed.
Of course, many people will be walking to school with their children or getting the bus with their children to school. And I wonder again that perhaps the same principles apply, that you are not looking at each other and perhaps it's therefore a less intense, more gentle environment.
Yes, walking and talking as a family is a really good way of having open conversations, because I think people feel much more, you can be silent, you're in the rhythm of the pace with each other, and that you often feel more open as a result. Mm.
Helen, Julia's version of the school run does sound very peaceful and a very civilised moment in the day. I'm not sure my memories of it are quite like that.
Yes, I think not every day is the same. Some days it's all shoes, deodorant, go, go, go.
Which day is not like that?
Birthdays? Yes. I think, as Julia said, I think walking with your children is one of the most sort of wonderful moments to connect. And it is funny that you're not making eye contact. And I think I spoke to my 13-year-old son last night about it, and he said, actually, he has his best conversations with his schoolmates walking home because they're not looking at each other and they can sort of open up. And so we were having this conversation, but I found during the pandemic, when we all had to do, obviously, the miserable compulsory family walk, that's when I'd have my, come on, we've got an hour, let's go. We would have these beautiful conversations. And I think the school run is another opportunity, I find, that 10 minutes, you know, it can be quite tender. They can hold your hand and open up about, you know, maybe school bullying and things like that. And when you get home, it's like, oh, where's Wi-Fi? Oh, I need a snack. And then they sort of disappear. So I think you have this sort of precious moment where you're not distracted by anything else.
The late Bill Turnbull told me that his best conversations with his sons were often when they were watching football. That, you know, obviously not a particularly dramatic moments in the action, but again, that sense that you're there for some, you're not there to talk.
Yes, yes, yeah. And I think having almost the finite time, I have these great sort of, I sometimes make up why we need to go to the supermarket so I can have 5 minutes with my teens. And I think having that time is really good. And it's out of the house as well. Sometimes when you're in the house, you've got a million things and you're really present when you're on a walk as well.
William does say, Julia, that obviously he, you know, his passion for doing something about homelessness comes from his mother, and you knew her, didn't you? And, you know, she spoke to her sons about that. I don't think we know whether that happened on the home, on the school run, but again, it's a link with what he learnt in his childhood.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, children learn from what your parents role model. So if it's their interests, you learn from them. If it's what they're doing, you learn from them. And obviously from what they say. So he would have been very much influenced by her.
And what if there is something really tricky to bring up, you know, you as parents aren't getting on with each other? Can the school run be a moment for that?
No, I don't think so. I think you acknowledge it and say, you know, this is an important conversation and let's bookmark it. You know, let's put it on the shelf and we'll talk about it when you come home, you know, or later in the day, because there's no time to process it and kind of, you don't want them going into school troubled, but you